mentioned. Mike Catlin asked what other entrances there were, and Ollie and Brown quickly ticked them off. Two loading doors in addition to the one Norm had opened. The main in-out doors. The window in the manager's office, thick, reinforced glass, securely locked. Talking about these things had a paradoxical effect. It made the danger seem more real, but at the same time made us feel better. Even Billy felt it. He asked if he could go get a candy bar. I told him it would be all right so long as he didn't go near the big windows. When he was out of earshot, a man near Mike Kaplan said,
"Okay, what are we going to do about those windows? The old lady may be as crazy as a bedbug, but she could be right about something moving in after dark."
"Maybe the fog will blow over by then," a woman said.
"Maybe," the man said, "and maybe not."
"Any ideas?" I asked Bud and Dolly.
"Hold on a sec,"
the man near Hadlin said.
"I'm Dan Miller, from Lynn, Massachusetts.
You don't know me, no reason why you should. But I got a place on Highland Lake. Bought it just this year. Got held up for it, is more like it, but I had to have it." There were a few chuckles.
"Anyway, I saw a whole pile of fertilizer and lawn food bags down there. 25-pound sacks, most of them. We could put them up like sandbags, leave loopholes to look out through."
Now more people were nodding and talking excitedly. I almost said something, then held it back. Miller was right. Putting those bags up could do no harm and might do some good. But my mind went back to that tentacle squeezing the dog food bag. I thought that one of the bigger tentacles could probably do the same for a 25-pound bag of Green Acres lawn food or Vigoro. But a sermon on that wouldn't get us out or improve anyone's mood. People began to break up, talking about getting it done, and Miller yelled,
"Hold it! Hold it! Let's thrash this out while we're all together."
They came back, a loose congregation of 50 or 60 people in the corner formed by the beer cooler, the storage doors, and the left end of the meat case, where Mr. McVeigh always seems to put the things no one wants, like sweetbreads and scotch eggs and sheep's brains and head cheese. Billy wove his way through them with a 5-year-old's unconscious agility in the world of giants and held up a Hershey bar.
"Want this, Daddy?"
"Thanks." I took it. It tasted sweet and good.
"This is probably a stupid question," Miller resumed, "but we ought to fill in the blanks. Anyone got any firearms?"
There was a pause. People looked around at each other and shrugged. An old man with grizzled white hair who introduced himself as Ambrose Cornell said he had a shotgun in the trunk of his car.
"I'll try for it if you want,"
Ollie said.
"Right now, I don't think that would be a good idea, Mr. Cornell."
Cornell grunted.
"Right now, neither do I, son, but I thought I ought to make the offer."
"Well, I didn't really think so," Dan Miller said, "but I thought..."
"Wait, hold it a minute,"
a woman said. It was the lady in the cranberry-colored sweatshirt and the dark green slacks. She had sandy blonde hair and a good figure, a very pretty young woman. She opened her purse, and from it she produced a medium-sized pistol. The crowd made an awing sound as if they had just seen a magician do a particularly fine trick. The woman, who had been blushing, blushed that much harder. She rooted in her purse again and brought out a box of Smith & Wesson ammunition.
"I'm Amanda Dumfries," she said to Miller. "This gun, my husband's idea. He thought I should have it for protection. I've carried it unloaded for 2 years.
Is your husband here, ma'am?"
"No, he's in New York, on business. He's gone on business a lot. That's why he wanted me to carry the gun."
"Well," Miller said,
"if you can use it, you ought to keep it. What is it, a 38? "Yes. And I've never fired it in my life except on a target range once."
Miller took the gun, fumbled around, and got the cylinder to open after a few moments. He checked to make sure it was not loaded.
"Okay," he said. "We got a gun. Who shoots good?"
"I sure don't."
People glanced at each other. No one said anything at first. Then, reluctantly, Ollie said,
"I target shoot quite a lot. I have a Colt 45 and a Llama 25.
"You?"
Brown said.
"Huh,
You'll be too drunk to see by dark.
Ollie said very clearly,
Why don't you just shut up and write down your names?
Brown goggled at him, opened his mouth, then decided, wisely, I think, to shut it again.
It's yours,
Miller said, blinking a little at the exchange. He handed it over, and Ollie checked it again, more professionally. He put the gun into his right front pants pocket and slipped the cartridge box into his breast pocket, where it made a bulge like a pack of cigarettes. Then he leaned back against the cooler, round face still trickling sweat, and cracked a fresh beer, the sensation that I was seeing a totally unsuspected Ollie Weeks persisted.
Thank you, Mrs. Dumfries, Miller said.
Don't mention it, she said, and I thought fleetingly that if I were her husband and proprietor of those green eyes and that full figure, I might not travel so much. Giving your wife a gun could be seen as a ludicrously symbolic act.
This may be silly, too,
Miller said, turning back to Brown, with his clipboard and Ollie with his beer.
But there aren't anything like flamethrowers in the place, are there?
Oh, shit, Buddy Eagleton said, and then went as red as Amanda Dumfries had done.
What is it?
Mike Hatland asked.
Well, until last week we had a whole case of those little blow torches. The kind you use around your house to solder leaky pipes or mend your exhaust systems or whatever. You remember those, Mr. Brown?
Brown nodded, looking sour.
Sold out?
Miller asked.
No, they didn't go at all. We only sold three or four and sent the rest of the case back.
What a pisser.
I mean, what a shame.
Blushing so deeply he was almost purple, Buddy Eagleton retired into the background again. We had matches, of course, and salt. Someone said vaguely that he had heard salt was the thing to put on bloodsuckers and things like that. And all kinds of O-cedar mops and long-handled brooms. Most of the people continued to look heartened, and Jim and Myron were too potso to sound a dissenting note. But I met Ollie's eyes and saw a calm hopelessness in them that was worse than fear. He and I had seen the tentacles. The idea of throwing salt on them or trying to fend them off with the handles of those cedar mops was funny, in a ghastly way.
Mike, Miller said, why don't you crew this little adventure? I want to talk to Ollie and Dave here for a minute.
Glad to, Hatland clapped Dan Miller on the shoulder. Somebody had to take charge, and you did it good. Welcome to town.
Does this mean I get a kickback on my taxes?
Miller asked. He was a banty little guy with red hair that was receding. He looked like the sort of guy you can't help liking on short notice, and just maybe the kind of guy you can't help not liking after he's been around for a while. The kind of guy who knows how to do everything better than you do.
No way,
Hatland said, laughing. Hatland walked off. Miller glanced down at my son. Don't worry about Billy, I said.
Man, I've never been so worried in my whole life, Miller said.
Now,
Ollie agreed, and dropped an empty into the beer cooler. He got a fresh one and opened it. There was a soft hiss of escaping gas.
I got a look at the way you two glanced at each other,
Miller said. I finished my Hershey bar and got a beer to wash it down with.
Tell you what I think,
Miller said.
We ought to get half a dozen people to wrap some of those mop handles with cloth, and then tie them down with twine. Then I think we ought to get a couple of those cans of charcoal lighter fluid all ready. If we cut the tops right off the cans, we could have some torches pretty quick.
I nodded. That was good. Almost surely not good enough, not if you had seen Norm dragged out, but it was better than salt.
That would give them something to think about, at least,
Ollie said. Miller's lips pressed together.
That bad, huh?
He said.
That bad.
Ollie agreed and worked his beer. By 4:30 that afternoon, the sacks of fertilizer and lawn food were in place, and the big windows were blocked off except for narrow loopholes. A watchman had been placed at each of these, and beside each watchman was a tin of charcoal lighter fluid with the top cut off and a supply of mop-handled torches. There were five loopholes, and Dan Miller had arranged a rotation of sentries for each one. When 4:30 came around, I was sitting on a pile of bags at one of the loopholes, Billy at my side. We were looking out into the mist. Just beyond the window was a red bench where people sometimes waited for their rides with their groceries beside them. Beyond that was the parking lot. The mist swirled slowly, thick and heavy. There was moisture in it, but how dull it seemed, and gloomy. Just looking at it made me feel gutless and lost.
"Daddy, do you know what's happening?"
Billy asked. "No, hon," I said. He fell silent for a bit, looking at his hands, which lay limply in the lap of his tough-skin jeans.
"Why doesn't somebody come and rescue us?" he said finally. "The state police or the FBI or someone."
"I don't know."
"Do you think Mom's okay?"
"Billy, I just don't know," I said, and put an arm around him.
"I want her awful bad,"
Billy said, struggling with tears.
"I'm sorry about the times I was bad to her."
"Billy," I said, and had to stop. I could taste salt in my throat, and my voice wanted to tremble.
"Will it be over?"
Billy asked.
"Daddy, will it?"
"I don't know," I said. And he put his face in the hollow of my shoulder, and I held the back of his head, felt the delicate curve of his skull just under the thick growth of his hair. I found myself remembering the evening of my wedding day, watching Steph take off the simple brown dress she had changed into after the ceremony. She had had a big purple bruise on one hip from running into the side of a door the day before. I remembered looking at the bruise and thinking, when she got that, she was still Stephanie Stepanek, and feeling something like wonder. Then we had made love, and outside, it was spitting snow from a dull gray December sky. Billy was crying. "Shh, Billy, shh," I said, rocking his head against me. But he went on crying. It was the sort of crying that only mothers know how to fix right. Premature night came inside the Federal Foods. Miller and Hatlin and Bud Brown handed out flashlights, the whole stock, about 20. Norton clamored loudly for them on behalf of his group and received two. The lights bobbed here and there in the aisles like uneasy phantoms. I held Billy against me and looked out through the loophole. The milky, translucent quality of the light out there hadn't changed much. It was putting up the bags that had made the market so dark. Several times I thought I saw something, but it was only jumpiness. One of the others raised a hesitant false alarm. Billy saw Mrs. Terman again and went to her eagerly, even though she hadn't been over to sit for him all summer. She had one of the flashlights and handed it over to him amiably enough. Soon he was trying to write his name in light on the blank glass faces of the frozen food cases. She seemed as happy to see him as he was to see her, and in a little while they came over. Hattie Terman was a tall, thin woman with lovely red hair just beginning to streak gray. A pair of glasses hung from an ornamental chain, the sort, I believe, it is illegal for anyone except middle-aged women to wear, on her breast.
"Is Stephanie here, David?" she asked.
"No, at home," she nodded.
"Alan, too. How long are you on watch here?"
"Until 6.
"Have you seen anything?"
"No, just the mist."
"I'll keep Billy until 6 if you like."
"Would you like that, Billy?"
"Yes, please,"
he said, swinging the flashlight above his head in slow arcs and watching it play across the ceiling.
"God will keep your Steffi, and Alan, too," Mrs. Terman said,
and led Billy away by the hand. She spoke with serene sureness, but there was no conviction in her eyes. Around 5:30, the sounds of excited argument rose near the back of the store. Someone jeered at something someone else had said, and someone, it was Buddy Eagleton, I think, shouted, "You're crazy if you go out there!" Several of the flashlight beams pooled together at the center of the controversy, and they moved toward the front of the store. Mrs. Carmody's shrieking, derisive laugh split the gloom, as abrasive as fingers drawn down a slate blackboard. Above the babble of voices came the boom of Norton's courtroom tenor. "Let us pass, please. Let us pass." The man at the loophole next to mine left his place to see what the shouting was about. I decided to stay where I was. Whatever the concatenation was, it was coming my way. "Please," Mike Hatlin was saying. "Please, let's talk this thing through." "There is nothing to talk about," Norton proclaimed. Now his face swam out of the gloom. It was determined and haggard and wholly wretched. He was holding one of the two flashlights allocated to the flat earthers. The corkscrewed tufts of hair still stuck up behind his ears like a cuckold's horns. He was at the head of an extremely small procession, 5 of the original 9 or 10. "We are going out," he said.
"Don't stick to this craziness," Miller said. "Mike's right. We can talk it over, can't we? Mr. McVeigh is going to barbecue some chicken over the gas grill. We can all sit down and eat and just..."
He got in Norton's way, and Norton gave him a push. Miller didn't like it. His face flushed and then set in a hard expression.
"Do what you want, then," he said. "But you're as good as murdering these other people."
With all the evenness of great resolve or unbreakable obsession, Norton said, "We'll send help back for you." One of his followers murmured agreement, but another quietly slipped away. Now there was Norton and 4 others. Maybe that wasn't so bad. Christ himself could only find 12.
"Listen," Mike Hatlin said. "Mr. Norton, Brent, at least stay for the chicken. Get some hot food inside you.
And give you a chance to go on talking? I've been in too many courtrooms to fall for that. You've psyched out 6 of my people already."
"Your people?" Hatlin almost groaned it. "Your people? Good Christ, what kind of talk is that? They're people, that's all. This is no game, and it's surely not a courtroom. There are, for want of a better word, there are things out there. And what's the sense of getting yourself killed?"
"Things, you say?" Norton said, sounding superficially amused. "Where? Your people have been on watch for 2 hours now. Who's seen one?"
"Well, out back, in the..."
"No, no, no," Norton said, shaking his head. "That ground has been covered and covered. We're going out..."
"No,"
someone whispered, and it echoed and spread, sounding like the rustle of dead leaves at dusk of an October evening.
"No, no.
Will you restrain us?"
a shrill voice asked. This was one of Norton's people, to use his word. An elderly lady wearing bifocals.
"Will you restrain us?"
The soft babble of negatives died away.
"No,"
Mike said.
"No, I don't think anyone will restrain you."
I whispered in Billy's ear. He looked at me, startled and questioning.
"Go on now," I said. "Be quick."
He went. Norton ran his hands through his hair, a gesture as calculated as any ever made by a Broadway actor. I had liked him better pulling the cord of his chainsaw fruitlessly, cussing and thinking himself unobserved. I could not tell then, and do not know any better now, if he believed in what he was doing or not. I think down deep that he knew what was going to happen. I think that the logic he had paid lip service to all his life turned on him at the end like a tiger that has gone bad and mean. He looked around restlessly, seeming to wish that there was more to say. Then he led his 4 followers through one of the checkout lanes. In addition to the elderly woman, there was a chubby boy of about 20, a young girl, and a man in blue jeans wearing a golf cap tipped back on his head. Norton's eyes caught mine, widened a little, and then started to swing away.
"Brandt, wait a minute," I said.
"I don't want to discuss it any further,
certainly not with you."
"I know you don't. I just want to ask a favor." I looked around and saw Billy coming back toward the checkouts at a run.
"What's that?"
Norton asked suspiciously as Billy came up and handed me a package done up in cellophane.
"Clothesline," I said.
I was vaguely aware that everyone in the market was watching us now, loosely strung out on the other side of the cash registers and checkout lanes.
"It's the big package, 300 feet.
"So?"
"I wondered if you'd tie one end around your waist before you go out."
"I'll let it out." "When you feel it come up tight, just tie it around something. It doesn't matter what. A car door handle would do."
"What in God's name for?"
It will tell me you got at least 300 feet, I said. Something in his eyes flickered, but only momentarily. No, he said. I shrugged. Okay, good luck, anyhow. Abruptly, the man in the golf cap said,
I'll do it, mister. No reason not to.
Norton swung on him, as if to say something sharp, and the man in the golf cap studied him calmly. There was nothing flickering in his eyes. He had made his decision, and there was simply no doubt in him. Norton saw it, too, and said nothing. Thanks, I said. I slit the wrapping with my pocket knife, and the clothesline accordioned out in stiff loops. I found one loose end and tied it around Golf Cap's waist in a loose cranny. He immediately untied it and cinched it tighter with a good, quick, sheep-bend knot. There was not a sound in the market. Norton shifted uneasily from foot to foot. You want to take my knife? I asked the man in the golf cap.
I got one.
He looked at me with that same calm contempt.
You just see to paying out your line. If it binds up, I'll chuck her.
Are we all ready? Norton asked, too loud. The chubby boy jumped as if he had been goosed. Getting no response, Norton turned to go. Grant, I said, and held out my hand. Good luck, man. He studied my hand as if it were some dubious foreign object. We'll send back help, he said finally, and pushed through the outdoor. That thin, acrid smell came in again. The others followed him out. Mike Catalan came down and stood beside me. Norton's party of five stood in the milky, slow-moving fog. Norton said something, and I should have heard it, but the mist seemed to have an odd damping effect. I heard nothing but the sound of his voice and two or three isolated syllables, like the voice on the radio heard from some distance. They moved off. Hatlin held the door a little way open. I paid out the clothesline, keeping as much slack in it as I could, mindful of the man's promise to chuck the rope if he found him up. There was still not a sound. Billy stood beside me, motionless, but seeming to thrum with his own inner current. Again, there was that weird feeling that the five of them did not so much disappear into the fog as become invisible. For a moment, their clothes seemed to stand alone, and then they were gone. You were not really impressed with the unnatural density of the mist until you saw people swallowed up in a space of seconds. I paid the line out. A quarter of it went, then a half. It stopped going out for a moment. It went from a live thing to a dead one in my hands. I held my breath. Then it started to go out again. I paid it through my fingers, and suddenly remembered my father taking me to see the Gregory Peck film of Moby Dick at the Brookside. I think I smiled a little. Three quarters of the line was gone now. I could see the end of it lying beside one of Billy's feet. Then the rope stopped moving through my hands again. It lay motionless for perhaps 5 seconds, and then another 5 feet jerked out. Then it suddenly whipsawed violently to the left, twanging off the edge of the outdoor. 20 feet of rope suddenly paid out, making a thin heat across my left palm. And from out of the mist there came a high, wavering scream. It was impossible to tell the sex of the screamer. The rope whipsawed in my hands again, and again. It skated across the space in the doorway to the right, then back to the left. A few more feet paid out. And then there was a ululating howl from out there that brought an answering moan from my son. Hatlin stood aghast. His eyes were huge. One corner of his mouth turned down, trembling. The howl was abruptly cut off. There was no sound at all for what seemed to be forever. Then the old lady cried out. This time there could be no doubt about who it was.
"Get it off of me!" she screamed. "Oh, my Lord! My Lord, get it!"
Then her voice was cut off, too. Almost all of the rope abruptly ran out through my loosely closed fist, giving me a hotter burn this time. Then it went completely slack, and a sound came out of the mist, a thick, loud grunt that made all the spit in my mouth dry up. It was like no sound I've ever heard, but the closest approximation might be a movie set in the African veld or a South American swamp. It was the sound of a big animal. It came again, low and tearing and savage. Once more. And then it subsided to a series of low mutterings. Then it was completely gone.
"Close the door,"
Amanda Dumfries said in a trembling voice.
"Please."
"In a minute," I said, and began to yank the line back in. It came out of the mist and piled up around my feet in untidy loops and snarls. About 3 feet from the end, the new white clothesline went barn red.
"Death!"
Mrs. Carmody screamed.
"Death to go out there! Now do you see?"
The end of the clothesline was a chewed and frayed tangle of fiber and little puffs of cotton. The little puffs were dewed with minute drops of blood. No one contradicted Mrs. Carmody. Mike Haplin let the door swing shut. 7. The first night. Mr. McVeigh had worked in Bridgeton cutting meat ever since I was 12 or 13, and I had no idea what his first name was or his age might be. He had set up a gas grill under one of the small exhaust fans. The fans were still now, but presumably they still gave some ventilation. And by 6:30 p.m., the smell of cooking chicken filled the market. Bud Brown didn't object. It might have been shock, but more likely he had recognized the fact that his fresh meat and poultry wasn't getting any fresher. The chicken smelled good, but not many people wanted to eat. Mr. McVeigh, small and spare and neat in his whites, cooked the chicken nevertheless and laid the pieces 2 by 2 on paper plates and lined them up cafeteria style on top of the meat counter. Mrs. Terman brought Billy and me each a plate, garnished with helpings of deli potato salad. I ate as best I could, but Billy would not even pick at his. "You got to eat, big guy," I said.
"I'm not hungry,"
he said, putting the plate aside. "You can't get big and strong if you don't." Mrs. Terman, sitting slightly behind Billy, shook her head at me. "Okay," I said. "Go get a peach and eat it, at least. Okay?"
"What if Mr. Brown says something?"
"If he says something, you come back and tell me."
"Okay, Dad."
He walked away slowly. He seemed to have shrunk somehow. It hurt my heart to see him walk that way. Mr. McVeigh went on cooking chicken, apparently not minding that only a few people were eating it, happy in the act of cooking. As I think I have said, there are all ways of handling a thing like this. You wouldn't think it would be so, but it is. The mind is a monkey. Mrs. Terman and I sat halfway up the patent medicines aisle. People were sitting in little groups all over the store. No one except Mrs. Carmody was sitting alone. Even Myron and his buddy Jim were together. They were both passed out by the beer cooler. 6 new men were watching the loopholes. One of them was Ollie, gnawing a leg of chicken and drinking a beer. The mop-handled torches leaned beside each of the watchposts, a can of charcoal lighter fluid next to each. But I don't think anyone really believed in the torches the way they had before. Not after that low and terribly vital grunting sound. Not after the chewed and blood-soaked clothesline. If whatever was out there decided it wanted us, it was going to have us. It or they.
"How bad will it be tonight?"
Mrs. Terman asked. Her voice was calm, but her eyes were sick and scared. "Hattie, I just don't know."
"You let me keep Billy as much as you can. I'm... Davy, I think I'm in mortal terror."
She uttered a dry laugh.
"Yes, I believe that's what it is. But if I have Billy, I'll be all right. I'll be all right for him."
Her eyes were glistening. I leaned over and patted her shoulder.
"I'm so worried about Alan," she said. "He's dead, Davy. In my heart, I'm sure he's dead."
"No, Hattie, you don't know any such thing."
"But I feel it's true. Don't you feel anything about Stephanie? Don't you at least have a feeling?"
"No," I said, lying through my teeth. A strangled sound came from her throat, and she clapped a hand to her mouth. Her glasses reflected back the dim, murky light. "Billy's coming back," I murmured. He was eating a peach. Hattie Terman patted the floor beside her and said that when he was done, she would show him how to make a little man out of the peach pit and some thread. Billy smiled at her wanly, and Mrs. Terman smiled back. At 8 p.m., six new men went on at the loopholes, and Dolly came over to where I was sitting.
Where's Billy?
With Mrs. Terman up back, I said. They're doing crafts. They run through peach pit men and shopping bag masks and dapple dolls, and now Mr. McVeigh is showing him how to make pipe cleaner men. Holly took a long drink of beer and said,
Things are moving around out there.
I looked at him sharply. He looked back levelly.
I'm not drunk, he said. I've been trying, but haven't been able to make it. I wish I could, David.
What do you mean, things are moving around out there?
I can't say for sure. I asked Walter, and he said he had the same feeling, that parts of the mist would go darker for a minute, sometimes just a little smudge, sometimes a big dark place, like a bruise. Then it would fade back to gray. And the stuff is swirling around. Even Arnie Sims said he felt like something was going on out there, and Arnie's almost as blind as a bat.
What about the others?
They're all out of staters. Strangers to me, Ollie said. I didn't ask any of them.
How sure are you that you weren't just seeing things?
Sure, he said.
He nodded toward Mrs. Carmody, who was sitting by herself at the end of the aisle. None of it had hurt her appetite any. There was a graveyard of chicken bones on her plate. She was drinking either blood or V8 juice.
I think she was right about one thing, Ollie said. We'll find out. When it gets dark, we'll find out.
But we didn't have to wait until dark. When it came, Billy saw very little of it because Mrs. Terman kept him up back. Ollie was still sitting with me when one of the men up front gave out a shriek and staggered back from his post, pinwheeling his arms. It was approaching 8:30. Outside, the pearl-white mist had darkened to the dull, slaty color of a November twilight. Something had landed on the glass outside one of the loopholes.
Oh, my Jesus!
The man who had been watching there screamed,
Let me out! Let me out of this!
He tore around in a rambling circle, his eyes starting from his face, a thin lick of saliva at one corner of his mouth, glimmering in the deepening shadows. Then he took off, straight up the far aisle, past the frozen food cases. There were answering cries. Some people ran toward the front to see what had happened. Many others retreated toward the back, not caring and not wanting to see whatever was crawling on the glass out there. I started down toward the loophole, Ollie by my side. His hand was in the pocket that held Mrs. Dumfries' gun. Now one of the other watchers let out a cry, not so much of fear as disgust. Ollie and I slipped through one of the checkout lanes. Now I could see what had frightened the guy from his post. I couldn't tell what it was, but I could see it. It looked like one of the minor creatures in a Bosch painting, one of his hellacious murals. There was something almost horribly comic about it, too, because it also looked a little like one of those strange creations of vinyl and plastic you can buy for $1.89 to spring on your friends. In fact, exactly the sort of thing Norton had accused me of planting in the storage area. It was maybe 2 feet long, segmented, the pinkish color of burned flesh that has healed over. Bulbous eyes peered in 2 different directions at once from the ends of short, limber stalks. It clung to the window on fat sucker pads. From the opposite end there protruded something that was either a sexual organ or a stinger, and from its back there sprouted oversized membranous wings, like the wings of a housefly. They were moving very slowly as Ollie and I approached the glass. At the loophole to the left of us, where the man had made the disgusted cawing sound, 3 of the things were crawling on the glass. They moved sluggishly across it, leaving sticky snail trails behind them. Their eyes, if that is what they were, joggled on the end of the finger-thick stalks. The biggest was maybe 4 feet long. At times, they crawled right over each other.
Look at those goddamn things,
Tom Smalley said in a sickened voice. He was standing at the loophole on our right. I didn't reply. The bugs were all over the loopholes now, which meant they were probably crawling all over the building, like maggots on a piece of meat. It wasn't a pleasant image, and I could feel what chicken I had managed to eat now wanting to come up. Someone was sobbing. Mrs. Carmody was screaming about abominations from within the earth. Someone told her gruffly that she'd shut up if she knew what was good for her. Same old shit. Ollie took Mrs. Dumfries' gun from his pocket, and I grabbed his arm. Don't be crazy, he shook free. I know what I'm doing, he said. He tapped the barrel of the gun on the window. His face set in a nearly mask-like expression of distaste. The speed of the creature's wings increased until they were only a blur. If you hadn't known, you might have believed they weren't winged creatures at all. Then they simply flew away. Some of the others saw what Ollie had done and got the idea. They used the mop handles to tap on the windows. The things flew away, but came right back. Apparently, they had no more brains than your average housefly either. The near panic dissolved in a babble of conversation. I heard someone asking someone else what he thought those things would do if they landed on you. That was a question I had no interest in seeing answered. The tapping on the windows began to die away. Ollie turned toward me and started to say something. But before he could do more than open his mouth, something came out of the fog and snatched one of the crawling things off the glass. I think I screamed. I'm not sure. It was a flying thing. Beyond that, I could not have said for sure. The fog appeared to darken in exactly the way Ollie had described, only the dark smudge didn't fade away. It solidified into something with flapping, leathery wings, an albino white body, and reddish eyes. It thudded into the glass hard enough to make it shiver. Its beak opened. It scooped the pink thing in and was gone. The whole incident took no more than 5 seconds. I had a bare final impression of the pink thing wiggling and flapping as it went down the hatch, the way a small fish will wiggle and flap in the beak of a seagull. Now there was another thud, and yet another. People began screaming again, and there was a stampede toward the back of the store. Then there was a more piercing scream, one of pain, and Dolly said, "Oh, my God, that old lady fell down, and they just ran over her." He ran back through the checkout aisle. I turned to follow. And then I saw something that stopped me dead where I was standing. High up and to my right, one of the lawn food bags was sliding slowly backward. Tom Smalley was right under it, staring out into the mist through his loophole. Another of the pink bugs landed on the thick plate glass of the loophole where Ollie and I had been standing. One of the flying things swooped down and grabbed it. The old woman who had been trampled went on screaming in a shrill, cracked voice. That bag. That sliding bag. "Smalley!" I shouted. "Look out! Heads up!" In the general confusion, he never heard me. The bag teetered, then fell. It struck him squarely on the head. He went down hard, catching his jaw on the shelf that ran below the show window. One of the albino flying things was squirming its way through the jagged hole in the glass. I could hear the soft scraping sound that it made, now that some of the screaming had stopped. Its red eyes glittered in its triangular head, which was slightly cocked to one side. A heavy, hooked beak opened and closed rapaciously. It looked a bit like the paintings of pterodactyls you may have seen in the dinosaur books, more like something out of a lunatic's nightmare. I grabbed one of the torches and slam-dunked it into a can of charcoal lighter fluid, tipping it over and spilling a pool of the stuff across the floor. The flying creature paused on top of the lawn food bags, glaring around, shifting slowly and malignantly from one taloned foot to the other. It was a stupid creature, I am quite sure of that. Twice it tried to spread its wings, which struck the walls and then folded themselves over its hunched back like the wings of a griffin. The third time it tried, it lost its balance and fell clumsily from its perch, still trying to spread its wings. It landed on Tom Smalley's back. One flex of its claws, and Tom's shirt ripped wide open. Blood began to flow. I was there, less than 3 feet away. My torch was dripping lighter fluid. I was emotionally pumped up to kill it if I could, and then realized I had no matches to light it with. I had used the last one lighting a cigar from Mr. McVeigh an hour ago. The place was in pandemonium now. People had seen the thing roosting on Smalley's back, something no one in the world had seen before. It darted its head forward at a questing angle and tore a chunk of meat from the back of Smalley's neck. I was getting ready to use the torch as a bludgeon when the cloth-wrapped head of it suddenly blazed alight. Dan Miller was there, holding a Zippo lighter with a Marine emblem on it. His face was as harsh as a rock with horror and fury.
"Kill it," he said hoarsely. "Kill it if you can."
Standing beside him was Ollie. He had Mrs. Dumfries' .38 in his hand, but he had no clear shot. The thing spread its wings and flapped them once, apparently not to fly away, but to secure a better hold on its prey. and then its leathery white, membranous wings enfolded poor Smalley's entire upper body. Then the sounds came, mortal, tearing sounds that I cannot bear to describe in any detail. All of this happened in bare seconds. Then I thrust my torch at the thing. There was the sensation of striking something with no more real substance than a box kite. The next moment, the entire creature was blazing. It made a screeching sound, and its wings spread. Its head jerked, and its reddish eyes rolled with what I most sincerely hope was great agony. It took off with a sound like linen bedsheets flapping on a clothesline in a stiff spring breeze. It uttered that rusty, shrieking sound again. Heads turned up to follow its flaming, dying course. I think that nothing in the entire business stands in my memory so strongly as that bird thing blazing a zigzagging course above the aisles of the Federal Supermarket, dropping charred and smoking bits of itself here and there. It finally crashed into the spaghetti sauces, splattering ragu and prince and prima salsa everywhere like gouts of blood. It was little more than ash and bone. The smell of its burning was high and sickening. And underlying it, like a counterpoint, was the thin and acrid stench of the mist eddying in through the broken plate in the glass. For a moment, there was utter silence. We were united in the black wonder of that brightly flaming death flight. Then someone howled, others screamed, and from somewhere in the back I could hear my son crying. A hand grabbed me. It was Bud Brown. His eyes were bulging from their sockets. His lips were drawn back from his false teeth in a snarl. "One of those other things," he said, and pointed. One of the bugs had come in through the hole, and it now perched on a lawn food bag, housefly wings buzzing. You could hear them. It sounded like a cheap department store electric fan, eyes bulging from their stalks. Its pink and noxiously plump body was aspirating rapidly. I moved toward it. My torch was guttering, but not yet out. But Mrs. Repler, the third-grade teacher, beat me to it. She was maybe 55, maybe 60, rope-thin. Her body had a tough, dried-out look that always makes me think of beef jerky. She had a can of Raid in each hand, like some crazy gunslinger in an existential comedy. She uttered a snarl of anger that would have done credit to a caveman splitting the skull of an enemy. Holding the pressure cans out at the full length of each arm, she pressed the buttons. A thick spray of insect killer coated the thing. It went into throes of agony, twisting and turning crazily, and at last falling from the bags, bouncing off the body of Tom Smalley, who was dead beyond any doubt or question, and finally landing on the floor. Its wings buzzed madly, but they weren't taking it anywhere. They were too heavily coated with Raid. A few moments later, the wings slowed, then stopped. It was dead. You could hear people crying now, and moaning. The old lady who had been trampled was moaning. And you could hear laughter, the laughter of the damned. Mrs. Repler stood over her kill, her thin chest rising and falling rapidly. Hatlin and Miller had found one of those dollies that the stock boys used to trundle cases of things around the store, and together they heaved it atop the lawn food bags, blocking off the wedge-shaped hole in the glass. As a temporary measure, it was a good one. Amanda Dumfries came forward like a sleepwalker. In one hand, she held a plastic floor bucket. In the other, she held a whisk broom, still done up in its see-through wrapping. She bent, her eyes still wide and blank, and swept the dead pink thing, bug, slug, whatever it was, into the bucket. You could hear the crackle of the wrapping on the whisk broom as it brushed the floor. She walked over to the outdoor. There were none of the bugs on it. She opened it a little way and threw the bucket out. It landed on its side and rolled back and forth in ever-decreasing arcs. One of the pink things buzzed out of the night, landed on the floor pail, and began to crawl over it. Amanda burst into tears. I walked over and put an arm around her shoulders. At 1:30 the following morning, I was sitting with my back against the white enamel side of the meat counter in a semi-doze. Billy's head was in my lap. He was solidly asleep. Not far away, Amanda Dumfries was sleeping with her head pillowed on someone's jacket. Not long after the flaming death of the bird thing, Ollie and I had gone back out to the storage area and had gathered up half a dozen of the pads, such as the one I'd covered Billy with earlier. Several people were sleeping on these. We had also brought back several heavy crates of oranges and pears, and four of us working together had been able to swing them to the tops of the lawn food bags in front of the hole in the glass. The bird creatures would have a tough time shifting one of those crates. They weighed about 90 pounds each. But the birds and the bug-like things the birds ate weren't the only things out there. There was the tentacled thing that had taken Norm. There was the frayed clothesline to think about. There was the unseen thing that had uttered that low, guttural roar to think about. We had heard sounds like it since, sometimes quite distant, but how far was distant through the damping effect of the mist. And sometimes they were close enough to shake the building and make it seem as if the ventricles of your heart had suddenly been loaded up with ice water. Billy started in my lap and moaned. I brushed his hair, and he moaned more loudly. Then he seemed to find sleep's less dangerous waters again. My own doze was broken, and I was staring wide awake again. Since dark, I had only managed to sleep about 90 minutes, and that had been dream-haunted. In one of the dream fragments, it had been the night before again. Billy and Steffi were standing in front of the picture window, looking out at the black and slate-gray waters, out at the silver-spinning waterspout that heralded the storm. I tried to get to them, knowing that a strong enough wind could break the window and throw deadly glass darts all the way across the living room, but no matter how I ran, I seemed to get no closer to them. And then a bird rose out of the waterspout, a gigantic scarlet oiseau de mort, whose prehistoric wingspan darkened the entire lake from west to east. Its beak opened, revealing a maw the size of the Holland Tunnel, and as the bird came to gobble up my wife and son, a low, sinister voice began to whisper over and over again, "The Arrowhead Project. The Arrowhead Project. The Arrowhead Project." Not that Billy and I were the only ones sleeping poorly. Others screamed in their sleep, and some went on screaming after they woke up. The beer was disappearing from the cooler at a great rate. Buddy Eagleton had restocked it once from out back with no comment. Mike Hatlin told me the Somonex was gone. Not depleted, but totally wiped out. He guessed that some people might have taken 6 or 8 bottles. "There's some Nitol left," he said. "You want a bottle, David?" I shook my head and thanked him. And in the last aisle, down by Register 5, we had our winos. There were about 7 of them, all out-of-staters except for Lou Tattinger, who ran the Pine Tree car wash. Lou didn't need any excuse to sniff the cork, as the saying was. The wino brigade was pretty well anesthetized. Oh, yes, there were also 6 or 7 people who had gone crazy. Crazy isn't the best word. Perhaps I just can't think of the proper one, but there were these people who had lapsed into a complete stupor without benefit of beer, wine, or pills. They stared at you with blank and shiny doorknob eyes. The hard cement of reality had come apart in some unimaginable earthquake, and these poor devils had fallen through. In time, some of them might come back, if there was time. The rest of us had made our own mental compromises, and in some cases I suppose they were fairly odd. Mrs. Ressler, for instance, was convinced the whole thing was a dream, or so she said, and she spoke with some conviction. I looked over at Amanda. I was developing an uncomfortably strong feeling for her, uncomfortable but not exactly unpleasant. Her eyes were an incredible brilliant green. For a while, I had kept an eye on her to see if she was going to take out a pair of contact lenses, but apparently the color was true. I wanted to make love to her. My wife was at home, maybe alive, more probably dead, alone, either way, and I loved her. I wanted to get Billy and me back to her more than anything, but I also wanted to screw this lady named Amanda Dumfries. I tried to tell myself it was just the situation we were in, and maybe it was, but that didn't change the wanting. I dozed in and out, then jerked awake more fully around 3. Amanda had shifted into a sort of fetal position, her knees pulled up toward her chest, hands clasped between her thighs. She seemed to be sleeping deeply. Her sweatshirt had pulled up slightly on one side, showing clean white skin. I looked at it, and began to get an extremely useless and uncomfortable erection. I tried to divert my mind to a new track and got thinking about how I had wanted to paint Brent Norton yesterday. No, nothing as important as a painting, but just sit him on a log with my beer in his hand and sketch his sweaty, tired face and the two wings of his carefully processed hair sticking up untidily in the back. It could have been a good picture. It took me 20 years of living with my father to accept the idea that being good could be good enough. You know what talent is? The curse of expectation. As a kid, you have to deal with that, beat it somehow. If you can write, you think God put you on earth to blow Shakespeare away. Or if you can paint, maybe you think, I did, that God put you on earth to blow your father away. It turned out I wasn't as good as he was. I kept trying to be for longer than I should have, maybe. I had a show in New York, and it did poorly. The art critics beat me over the head with my father. A year later, I was supporting myself and staff with the commercial stuff. She was pregnant, and I sat down and talked to myself about it. The result of that conversation was a belief that serious art was always going to be a hobby for me, no more. I did Golden Girl shampoo ads. The one where the girl is standing astride her bike. The one where she's playing frisbee on the beach. The one where she's standing on the balcony of her apartment with a drink in her hand. I've done short story illustrations for most of the big slicks, but I broke into that field doing fast illustrations for the stories in the sleazier men's magazines. I've done some movie posters. The money comes in. We keep our heads nicely above water. I had one final show in Bridgeton just last summer. I showed 9 canvases that I had painted in 5 years, and I sold 6 of them. The one I absolutely would not sell showed the Federal Market by some queer coincidence. The perspective was from the far end of the parking lot. In my picture, the parking lot was empty except for a line of Campbell's beans and Frank's cans, each one larger than the last as they marched toward the viewer's eye. The last one appeared to be about 8 feet tall. The picture was titled Beans and False Perspective. A man from California who was a top exec in some company that makes tennis balls and rackets, and who knows what other sports equipment, seemed to want that picture very badly, and would not take no for an answer in spite of the NFS card tucked into the bottom left-hand corner of the spare wooden frame. He began at $600 and worked his way up to $4,000. He said he wanted it for his study. I would not let him have it, and he went away sorely puzzled. Even so, he didn't quite give up. He left his card in case I changed my mind. I could have used the money. That was the year we put the addition on the house and bought the 4-wheel drive, but I just couldn't sell it. I couldn't sell it because I felt it was the best painting I had ever done, and I wanted it to look at after someone would ask me with totally unconscious cruelty when I was going to do something serious. Then I happened to show it to Ollie Weeks one day last fall. He asked me if he could photograph it and run it as an ad one week. And that was the end of my own false perspective. Ollie had recognized my painting for what it was, and by doing so he forced me to recognize it too. A perfectly good piece of slick commercial art. No more. And, thank God, no less. I let him do it. And then I called the exec at his home in San Luis Obispo and told him he could have the painting for $2,500 if he still wanted it. He did, and I shipped it UPS to the coast. And since then, that voice of disappointed expectation, that cheated child's voice that can never be satisfied with such a mild superlative as good, has fallen pretty much silent. And except for a few rumbles, like the sounds of those unseen creatures somewhere out in the foggy night, it has been pretty much silent ever since. Maybe you can tell me. Why should the silencing of that childish, demanding voice seem so much like dying? Around 4 o'clock, Billy woke up, partially at least, and looked around with bleary, uncomprehending eyes.
Are we still here?
Yeah, honey, I said. We are. He started to cry with a weak helplessness that was horrible. Amanda woke up and looked at us.
Hey, kid, she said, and pulled him gently to her. Everything is going to look a little better come morning.
No, Billy said. No, it won't. It won't. It won't.
She said. Her eyes met mine over his head. It's past your bedtime.
I want my mother.
Yeah, you do, Amanda said. Of course you do. Billy squirmed around in her lap until he could look at me, which he did for some time, and then slept again. Thanks, I said. He needed you.
He doesn't even know me.
That doesn't change it.
So what do you think?
She asked. Her green eyes held mine steadily.
What do you really think?
Ask me in the morning.
I'm asking you now.
I opened my mouth to answer, and then Ollie Weeks materialized out of the gloom like something from a horror tale. He had a flashlight with one of the ladies' blouses over the lens, and he was pointing it toward the ceiling. It made strange shadows on his haggard face.
David,
he whispered. Amanda looked at him, first startled, then scared again. Ollie, what is it? I asked.
David,
he whispered again. Then,
come on, please.
I don't want to leave Billy. He just went to sleep.
I'll be with him,
Amanda said.
You better go.
Then, in a lower voice,
Jesus, this is never going to end.
8. What happened to the soldiers? With Amanda. A conversation with Dan Miller. I went with Ollie. He was headed for the storage area. As we passed the cooler, he grabbed a beer. Ollie, what is it?
I want you to see it.
He pushed through the double doors. They slipped shut behind us with a little backwash of air. It was cold. I didn't like this place, not after what had happened to Norm. A part of my mind insisted on reminding me that there was still a small scrap of dead tentacle lying around someplace. Ollie let the blouse drop from the lens of his light. He trained it overhead. At first, I had an idea that someone had hung a couple of mannequins from one of the heating pipes below the ceiling. That they had hung them on piano wire or something, a kid's Halloween trick. Then I noticed the feet, dangling about 7 inches off the cement floor. There were 2 piles of kicked-over cartons. I looked up at the faces, and a scream began to rise in my throat, because they were not the faces of department store dummies. Both heads were cocked to the side as if appreciating some horribly funny joke, a joke that had made them laugh until they turned purple. Their shadows. Their shadows thrown long on the wall behind them. Their tongues. Their protruding tongues. They were both wearing uniforms. They were the kids I had noticed earlier and had lost track of along the way. The army brats from... The scream. I could hear it starting in my throat as a moan, rising like a police siren, and then Ollie grabbed my arm just above the elbow.
Don't scream, David. No one knows about this but you and me, and that's how I want to keep it.
Somehow I bit it back.
Those army kids, I managed. From the Arrowhead Project, Ollie said. Sure.
Something cold was thrust into my hand. The beer can.
Drink this. You need it.
I drained the can completely dry. Ollie said,
I came back to see if we had any extra cartridges for that gas grill Mr. McVeigh has been using. I saw these guys. The way I figure, they must have gotten the nooses ready and stood on top of those 2 piles of cartons. They must have tied their hands for each other. And then balanced each other while they stepped through the length of rope between their wrists. So that their hands would be behind them, you know? Then, this is the way I figure, they stuck their heads into the nooses and pulled them tight by jerking their heads to one side. Maybe one of them counted to 3 and they jumped together. I don't know.
It couldn't be done, I said through a dry mouth. But their hands were tied behind them, all right. I couldn't seem to take my eyes away from that.
It could. If they wanted to bad enough, David, they could.
But why?
I think you know why. Not any of the tourists, the summer people, like that guy Miller. But there are people from around here who could make a pretty decent guess.
The Arrowhead Project? Ollie said.
I stand by one of those registers all day long, and I hear a lot. All this spring I've been hearing things about that damned Arrowhead thing. None of it good. The black ice on the lakes.
I thought of Bill Justy leaning in my window, blowing warm alcohol in my face. Not just atoms, but different atoms. Now these bodies hanging from that overhead pipe, the cocked heads, the dangling shoes, the tongues protruding like summer sausages. I realized with fresh horror that new doors of perception were opening up inside. New? Not so. Old doors of perception. The perception of a child who has not yet learned to protect itself by developing the tunnel vision that keeps out 90% of the universe. Children see everything their eyes happen upon, hear everything in their ears' range. But if life is the rise of consciousness, as a cruel work sampler my wife made in high school proclaims, then it is also the reduction of input. Terror is the widening of perspective and perception. The horror was in knowing I was swimming down to a place most of us leave when we get out of diapers and into training pants. I could see it on Ollie's face, too. When rationality begins to break down, the circuits of the human brain can overload. Axons grow bright and feverish. Hallucinations turn real. The quicksilver puddle at the point where perspective makes parallel lines seem to intersect is really there. The dead walk and talk. A rose begins to sing.
I've heard stuff from maybe 24 people, Ollie said. Justine Robards, Nick Tochai, Ben Michelson. You can't keep secrets in small towns. Things get out. Sometimes it's like a spring. It just bubbles up out of the earth and no one has an idea where it came from. You overhear something at the library and pass it on, or at the marina in Harrison. Christ knows where else, or why. But all spring and summer I've been hearing Arrowhead Project, Arrowhead Project. But these two, I said. Christ, Ollie, they're just kids. There were kids in Namu used to take years. I was there, I saw it.
But what would drive them to do this?
I don't know. Maybe they knew something. Maybe they only suspected. They must have known people in here would start asking them questions eventually. If there is an eventually.
If you're right, he said, it must be something really bad.
That storm,
Ollie said in his soft, level voice.
Maybe it knocked something loose up there. Maybe there was an accident. They could have been fooling around with anything. Some people claim they were messing with high-intensity lasers and mazes. Sometimes I hear fusion power. And suppose? Suppose they ripped a hole straight through into another dimension?
That's hogwash, I said.
Are they?
Ollie asked and pointed at the bodies. No. The question now is, what do we do?
I think we ought to cut them down and hide them,
he said promptly.
Put them under a pile of stuff people won't want. Dog food, dish detergent, stuff like that. If this gets out, it will only make things worse. That's why I came to you, David. I felt you are the only one I could really trust, I muttered.
It's like the Nazi war criminals killing themselves in their cells after the war was lost.
Yeah, I had that same thought.
We fell silent, and suddenly those soft shuffling noises began outside the steel loading door again, the sound of the tentacles feeling softly across it. We drew together. My flesh was crawling. Okay, I said.
We'll make it as quick as we can, Ollie said.
His sapphire ring glowed mutely as he moved his flashlight.
I want to get out of here fast.
I looked up at the ropes. They had used the same sort of clothesline the man in the golf cap had allowed me to tie around his waist. The nooses had sunk into the puffed flesh of their necks, and I wondered again what it could have been to make both of them go through with it. I knew what Ollie meant by saying that if the news of the double suicide got out, it would make things worse. For me, it already had, and I wouldn't have believed that possible. There was a snicking sound. Ollie had opened his knife, a good heavy job made for slitting open cartons, and, of course, cutting rope.
You or me?
He asked. I swallowed. One each. We did it. When I got back, Amanda was gone, and Mrs. Terman was with Billy. They were both sleeping. I walked down one of the aisles, and a voice said,
Mr. Drayton, David.
It was Amanda, standing by the stairs to the manager's office, her eyes like emeralds.
What was it?
Nothing, I said. She came over to me. I could smell faint perfume. And, oh, how I wanted her.
You liar, she said.
It was nothing. A false alarm.
If that's how you want it, she took my hand. I've just been up to the office. It's empty, and there's a lock on the door.
Her face was perfectly calm, but her eyes were lambent, almost feral, and a pulse beat steadily in her throat.
I saw the way you looked at me, she said. If we need to talk about it, it's no good. The Terman woman is with your son.
Yes. It came to me that this was a way, maybe not the best one, but a way, nevertheless, to take the curse off what Ollie and I had just done. Not the best way, just the only way. We went up the narrow flight of stairs and into the office. It was empty, as she had said, and there was a lock on the door. I turned it. In the darkness, she was nothing but a shape. I put my arms out, I touched her, and pulled her to me. She was trembling. We went down on the floor, first kneeling, kissing, and I cupped one firm breast and could feel the quick thudding of her heart through her sweatshirt. I thought of Steffi telling Billy not to touch the live wires. I thought of the bruise that had been on her hip when she took off the brown dress on our wedding night. I thought of the first time I had seen her biking across the mall of the University of Maine at Orono, me bound for one of Vincent Hutkins' classes with my portfolio under my arm. And my erection was enormous. We lay down then, and she said, "Love me, David. Make me warm." When she came, she dug into my back with her nails and called me by a name that wasn't mine. I didn't mind. It made us about even. When we came down, some sort of creeping dawn had begun. The blackness outside the loopholes went reluctantly to dull gray, then to chrome, then to the bright, featureless, and unsparkling white of a drive-in movie screen. Mike Hatlin was asleep in a folding chair he had scrounged somewhere. Dan Miller sat on the floor a little distance away, eating a Hostess donut, the kind that's powdered with white sugar. "Sit down, Mr. Drayton," he invited. I looked around for Amanda, but she was already halfway up the aisle. She didn't look back. Our act of love in the dark already seemed something out of a fantasy, impossible to believe even in this weird daylight. I sat down. "Have a donut." He held the box out. I shook my head. "All that white sugar is death. Worse than cigarettes." That made him laugh a little bit.
"In that case, have two."
I was surprised to find a little laughter left inside me. He had surprised it out, and I liked him for it. I did take two of his donuts. They tasted pretty good. I chased them with a cigarette, although it is not normally my habit to smoke in the mornings. "I ought to get back to my kid," I said. "He'll be waking up." Miller nodded.
"Those pink bugs," he said. "They're all gone. So were the birds. Hank Vannerman said the last one hit the windows about 4. Apparently, the wildlife is a lot more active when it's dark."
"You don't want to tell Brent Norton that," I said. "Or Norm." He nodded again and didn't say anything for a long time. Then he lit a cigarette of his own and looked at me.
"We can't stay here, Drayton," he said.
"There's food, plenty to drink.
The supplies don't have anything to do with it, and you know it. What do we do if one of the big beasties out there decides to break in instead of just going bump in the night? Do we try to drive it off with broom handles and charcoal lighter fluid?"
Of course, he was right. Perhaps the mist was protecting us in a way, hiding us. But maybe it wouldn't hide us for long, and there was more to it than that. We had been in the Federal for 18 hours, more or less, and I could feel a kind of lethargy spreading over me. Not much different from the lethargy I've felt on one or two occasions when I've tried to swim too far. There was an urge to play it safe, to just stay put, to take care of Billy, and maybe to bang Amanda Dumfries in the middle of the night, a voice murmured. To see if the mist wouldn't just lift, leaving everything as it had been. I could see it on the other faces as well, and it suddenly occurred to me that there were people now in the Federal who probably wouldn't leave under any circumstance. The very thought of going out the door after all that had happened would freeze them. Miller had been watching these thoughts cross my face, maybe. He said,
"There were about 80 people in here when that damn fog came. From that number you subtract the bag boy, Norton, and the four people that went out with him, and that man Smalley, that leaves 73.
And subtracting the two soldiers now resting under a stack of Purina puppy chow bags, it made 71.
Then you subtract the people who have just opted out,"
he went on. "There were 10 or 12 of those, say 10. That leaves about 63. But," he raised one sugar-powdered finger, "of those 63, we've got 20 or so that just won't leave. You'd have to drag them out kicking and screaming." "Which all goes to prove what?"
"That we've got to get out, that's all. And I'm going. Around noon, I think. I'm planning to take as many people as will come. I'd like you and your boy to come along."
"After what happened at Norton?"
"Norton went like a lamb to the slaughter. That doesn't mean I have to, or the people who come with me."
"How can you prevent it? We have exactly one gun."
"And lucky to have that. But if we could make it across the intersection, maybe we could get down to the Sportsman's Exchange on Main Street. They've got more guns there than you could shake a stick at."
"That's one if and one maybe too many."
"Drayton," he said, "it's an iffy situation."
That rolled very smoothly off his tongue, but he didn't have a little boy to watch out for. "Look, let it pass for now, okay? I didn't get much sleep last night, but I got a chance to think over a few things. Want to hear them?"
"Sure."
He stood up and stretched. "Take a walk over to the window with me." We went through the checkout lane nearest the bread racks and stood at one of the loopholes. The man who was keeping watch there said,
"The bugs are gone."
Miller slapped him on the back.
"Go get yourself a coffee, and, fella, I'll keep an eye out."
"Okay, thanks."
He walked away, and Miller and I stepped up to his loophole.
"So tell me what you see out there," he said.
I looked. The litter barrel had been knocked over in the night, probably by one of the swooping bird things, spilling a trash of papers, cans, and paper shake cups from the Dairy Queen down the road all over the hot top. Beyond that, I could see the rank of cars closest to the market fading into whiteness. That was all I could see, and I told him so.
"That blue Chevy pickup is mine," he said.
He pointed, and I could see just a hint of blue in the mist.
"But if you think back to when you pulled in yesterday, you'll remember that the parking lot was pretty jammed, right?"
I glanced back at my scout and remembered I had only gotten the space close to the market because someone else had been pulling out. I nodded. Miller said,
"Now couple something else with that fact, Drayton. Norton and his four, what did you call them?
Flat earthers."
"Yeah, that's good.
Just what they were.
They go out, right? Almost the full length of that clothesline. Then we heard those roaring noises, like there was a goddamn herd of elephants out there, right?"
"It didn't sound like elephants," I said. "It sounded like something from the primordial ooze," was the phrase that came to mind, but I didn't want to say that to Miller. Not after he had clapped that guy on the back and told him to go get a coffee and, like the coach jerking a player from the big game. I might have said it to Ollie, but not to Miller. "I don't know what it sounded like," I finished lamely.
"But it sounded big."
"Yeah. It had sounded pretty goddamn big."
"So how come we didn't hear cars getting bashed around? Screeching metal? Breaking glass?"
"Well, because..." I stopped. He had me. "I don't know," Miller said.
"No way they were out of the parking lot when whatever it was hit them. I'll tell you what I think. I think we didn't hear any cars getting around because a lot of them might be gone. Just gone. Fallen into the earth. Vaporized, you name it. Strong enough to splinter those beams and twist them out of shape and knock stuff off the shelves. And the town whistle stopped at the same time."
I was trying to visualize half the parking lot gone. Trying to visualize walking out there and just coming to a brand new drop in the land where the hot top, with its neat yellow-lined parking slots, left off. A drop, a slope, or maybe an out-and-out precipice falling away into the featureless white mist. After a couple of seconds, I said, "If you're right, How far do you think you're going to get in your pickup?
I wasn't thinking of my trunk. I was thinking of your four-wheel drive.
That was something to chew over, but not now. What else is on your mind? Miller was eager to go on.
The pharmacy next door, that's on my mind.
What about that? I opened my mouth to say I didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about, and then shut it with a snap. The Bridgeton Pharmacy had been doing business when we drove in yesterday. Not the laundromat, but the drugstore had been wide open, the doors chalked with rubber doorstops to let in a little cool air. The power outage had killed their air conditioning, of course. The door to the pharmacy could be no more than 20 feet from the door of the Federal Market. So why
haven't any of those people turned up over here?
Miller asked for me.
It's been 18 hours. Aren't they hungry? They're sure not over there eating Driftan and Stay-Free mini pads.
There's food, I said. They're always selling food items on special. Sometimes it's animal crackers, sometimes it's those toaster pastries, all sorts of things. Plus the candy rack.
I just don't believe they'd stick with stuff like that when there's all kinds of stuff over here.
What are you getting at?
What I'm getting at is that I want to get out, but I don't want to be dinner for some refugee from a grade B horror picture. 4 or 5 of us could go next door and check out the situation in the drugstore as sort of a trial balloon.
That's everything?
No, there's one other thing.
What's that?
Her,
Miller said simply, and jerked his thumb toward one of the middle aisles.
That crazy cunt, that witch.
It was Mrs. Carmody he had jerked his thumb at. She was no longer alone. 2 women had joined her. From their bright clothes, I guess they were probably tourists or summer people, ladies who had maybe left their families to just run into town and get a few things, and were now eaten up with worry over their husbands and kids, ladies eager to grasp at almost any straw, maybe even the black comfort of a Mrs. Carmody. Her pantsuit shone out with its same baleful resplendence. She was talking, gesturing, her face hard and grim. The 2 ladies in their bright clothes, but not as bright as Mrs. Carmody's pantsuit. No, and her gigantic satchel of a purse was still tucked firmly under 1 doughy arm. We're listening raptly.
She's another reason I want to get out, Drayton. By tonight, she'll have 6 people sitting with her. If those pink bugs and the birds come back tonight, she'll have a whole congregation sitting with her by tomorrow morning. Then we can start worrying about who she'll tell them to sacrifice to make it all better. Maybe me, or you, or that guy Haslin. Maybe your kid.
That's idiocy, I said. But was it? The cold chill crawling up my back said not necessarily.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 4, Skeleton Crew, by Stephen King, continuing with The Mist, on page 124. Mrs. Carmody's mouth moved and moved. The eyes of the tourist ladies were fixed on her wrinkled lips. Was it idiocy? I thought of the dusty, stuffed animals drinking at their looking-glass stream. Mrs. Carmody had power. Even staff, normally hard-headed and straight from the shoulder, invoked the old lady's name with unease. That crazy cunt, Miller had called her. That witch.
The people in this market are going through a Section 8 experience for sure, Miller said.
He gestured at the red-painted beams framing the show window segments, twisted and splintered and buckled out of shape.
Their minds probably feel like those beams look. Mine sure as shit does. I spent half of last night thinking I must have flipped out of my gourd, that I was probably in a straitjacket in Danvers, raving my head off about bugs and dinosaur birds and tentacles, and that it would all go away just as soon as the nice orderly came along and shot a wad of Thorazine into my arm.
His small face was strained and white. He looked at Mrs. Carmody and then back at me.
I tell you, it might happen. As people get flakier, she's going to look better and better to some of them. And I don't want to be around if that happens.
Mrs. Carmody's lips moving and moving, her tongue dancing around her old lady's snaggled teeth. She did look like a witch. Put her in a pointy black hat and she would be perfect. What was she saying to her 2 captured birds in their bright summer plumage?
Arrowhead Project? Black Spring? Abominations from the Cellars of the Earth? Human Sacrifice? Bullshit. All the same.
So what do you say?
I'll go this far, I answered him. We'll try going over to the drug. You, me, Ollie, if he wants to go, one or two others. Then we'll talk it over again. Even that gave me the feeling of walking out over an impossible drop on a narrow beam. I wasn't going to help Billy by killing myself. On the other hand, I wasn't going to help him by just sitting on my ass, either. 20 feet to the drugstore. That wasn't so bad.
When?
He asked. Give me an hour.
Sure, he said.
9. The expedition to the pharmacy. I told Mrs. Terman, and I told Amanda, and then I told Billy. He seemed better this morning. He had eaten 2 donuts and a bowl of Special K for breakfast. Afterward, I raced him up and down 2 of the aisles and even got him giggling a little. Kids are so adaptable that they can scare the living shit right out of him. He was too pale. The flesh under his eyes was still puffed from the tears he had cried in the night, and his face had a horribly used look. In a way, it had become like an old man's face, as if too much emotional voltage had been running behind it for too long. But he was still alive and still able to laugh, at least until he remembered where he was and what was happening. After the wind sprints, we sat down with Amanda and Hattie Terman and drank Gatorade from paper cups, and I told him I was going over to the drugstore with a few other people.
I don't want you to,
he said immediately, his face clouding. It'll be all right, Big Bill. I'll bring you a Spider-Man comic book.
I want you to stay here.
Now his face was not just cloudy, it was thundery. I took his hand. He pulled it away. I took it again. Billy, we have to get out of here sooner or later. You see that, don't you?
When the fog goes away.
But he spoke with no conviction at all. He drank his Gatorade slowly and without relish. Billy, it's been almost one whole day now.
I want Mommy.
Well, maybe this is the first step on the way to getting back to her. Mrs. Terman said,
Don't build the boy's hopes up, David.
What the hell? I snapped at her. The kid's got to hope for something. She dropped her eyes.
Yes, I suppose he does.
Billy took no notice of this.
Daddy, there are things out there. Things.
Yes, we know that. But a lot of them, not all, but a lot, don't seem to come out until it's nighttime.
They'll wait,
he said. His eyes were huge, centered on mine.
They'll wait in the fog, and when you can't get back inside, they'll come to eat you up, like in the fairy stories.
He hugged me with fierce, panicky tightness.
Daddy, please don't go.
I pried his arms loose as gently as I could and told him that I had to. But I'll be back, Billy.
All right,
he said huskily, but he wouldn't look at me anymore. He didn't believe I would be back. It was on his face, which was no longer thundery, but woeful and grieving. I wondered again if I could be doing the right thing, putting myself at risk. Then I happened to glance down the middle aisle and saw Mrs. Carmody there. She had gained a third listener, a man with a grizzled cheek and a mean and rolling bloodshot eye. His haggard brow and shaking hands almost screamed the word hangover. It was none other than your friend and his, Myron LaFleur, the fellow who had felt no compunction at all about sending a boy out to do a man's job. That crazy cunt. That witch. I kissed Billy and hugged him hard. Then I walked down to the front of the store, but not down the housewares aisle. I didn't want to fall under her eye. 3/4 of the way down, Amanda caught up with me.
Do you really have to do this?
She asked. Yes, I think so.
Forgive me if I say it sounds like so much macho bullshit to me.
There were spots of color high on her cheeks, and her eyes were greener than ever. She was highly, no, royally pissed. I took her arm and recapped my discussion with Dan Miller. The riddle of the cars and the fact that no one from the pharmacy had joined us didn't move her much. The business about Mrs. Carmody did.
He could be right, she said.
Do you really believe that?
I don't know. There's a poisonous feel to that woman.
And if people are frightened badly enough for long enough, they'll turn to anyone that promises a solution.
But humans sacrifice, Amanda?
The Aztecs were into it,
she said evenly.
Listen, David, you come back. If anything happens, anything, you come back. Cut and run if you have to. Not for me. What happened last night was nice, but that was last night. Come back for your boy.
Yes, I will.
I wonder, she said.
And now she looked like Billy, haggard and old. It occurred to me that most of us looked that way, but not Mrs. Carmody. Mrs. Carmody looked younger somehow and more vital, as if she had come into her own, as if she were thriving on it. We didn't get going until 9:30 a.m. Seven of us went. Ollie, Dan Miller, Mike Hatlin, Myron LaFleur's erstwhile buddy Jim, also hungover, but seemingly determined to find some way to atone, Buddy Eagleton, myself. The seventh was Hilda Rettler. Miller and Hatlin tried half-heartedly to talk her out of coming. She would have none of it. I didn't even try. I suspected she might be more competent than any of us, except maybe for Ollie. She was carrying a small canvas shopping basket, and it was loaded with an arsenal of Raid and Black Flag spray cans, all of them uncapped and ready for action. In her free hand, she held a Spalding Jimmy Connors tennis racket from a display of sporting goods in aisle two.
"What you gonna do with that, Mrs. Rettler?"
Jim asked.
"I don't know,"
she said. She had a low, raspy, competent voice.
"But it feels right in my hand."
She looked him over closely, and her eye was cold.
"Jim Crondon, isn't it? Didn't I have you in school?"
Jim's lips stretched in an uneasy, egg-sucked grin.
"Yes'm, me and my sister Pauline."
"Too much to drink last night?"
Jim, who towered over her and probably outweighed her by 100 pounds, blushed to the roots of his American Legion crew cut.
"Oh, no."
She turned away curtly, cutting him off.
"I think we're ready,"
she said. All of us had something, although you would have called it an odd assortment of weapons. Ollie had Amanda's gun. Buddy Eagleton had a steel pinch bar from out back somewhere. I had a broom handle.
"Okay,"
Dan Miller said, raising his voice a bit.
"You folks want to listen up a minute?"
A dozen people had drifted down toward the outdoor to see what was going on. They were loosely knotted, and to their right stood Mrs. Carmody and her new friend.
"We're going over to the drugstore to see what the situation is there. Hopefully, we'll be able to bring something back to aid Mrs. Clapham."
She was the lady who had been trampled yesterday when the bugs came. One of her legs had been broken, and she was in a great deal of pain. Miller looked us over.
"We're not going to take any chances," he said. "At the first sign of anything threatening, we're going to pop back into the market."
"And bring all the fiends of hell down on our heads,"
Mrs. Carmody cried.
"She's right,"
one of the summer ladies seconded.
"You'll make them notice us. You'll make them come. Why can't you just leave well enough alone?"
There was a murmur of agreement from some of the people who had gathered to watch us go. I said, "Lady, is this what you call well enough?" She dropped her eyes, confused. Mrs. Carmody marched a step forward. Her eyes were blazing.
"You'll die out there, David Drayton. Do you want to make your son an orphan?"
She raised her eyes and raked all of us with them. Buddy Eagleton dropped his eyes and simultaneously raised the pinch bar, as if to ward her off.
"All of you will die out there. Haven't you realized that the end of the world has come? The fiend has been let loose. Star Wormwood blazes, and each one of you that steps out that door will be torn apart, and they'll come for those of us who are left, just as this good woman said. Are you people going to let that happen?"
She was appealing to the onlookers now, and a little mutter ran through them.
"After what happened to the unbelievers yesterday? It's death! It's death! It's..."
A can of peas flew across two of the checkout lanes suddenly and struck Mrs. Carmody on the right breast. She staggered backward with a startled squawk. Amanda stood forward.
"Shut up," she said. "Shut up, you miserable buzzard!" "She serves the foul one,"
Mrs. Carmody screamed. A jittery smile hung on her face.
Who did you sleep with last night, Mrs.? Who did you lie down with last night? Mother Comedy sees. Oh, yes, Mother Comedy sees what others miss.
But the moment's spell she had created was broken, and Amanda's eyes never wavered.
Are we going, or are we going to stand here all day?
Mrs. Rettler asked. And we went. God help us, we went. Dan Miller was in the lead. Ollie came second. I was last, with Mrs. Rettler in front of me. I was as scared as I've ever been, I think, and the hand wrapped around my broom handle was sweaty slick. There was that thin, acrid, and unnatural smell of the mist. By the time I got out the door, Miller and Dolly had already faded into it, and Hatlin, who was third, was nearly out of sight. Only 20 feet, I kept telling myself. Only 20 feet. Mrs. Rappler walked slowly and firmly ahead of me, her tennis racket swinging lightly from her right hand. To our left was a red cinder block wall. To our right, the first rank of cars, looming out of the mist like ghost ships. Another trash barrel materialized out of the whiteness, and beyond that was a bench where people sometimes sat to wait their turn at the payphone. Only 20 feet. Miller's probably there by now. 20 feet is only 10 or 12 paces, so...
Oh, my God! Miller screamed. Oh, dear sweet God, look at this!
Miller had gotten there, all right. Buddy Eagleton was ahead of Mrs. Rappler, and he turned to run, his eyes wide and starry. She batted him lightly in the chest with her tennis racket.
Where do you think you're going?
She asked in her tough, slightly raspy voice, and that was all the panic there was. The rest of us drew up to Miller. I took one glance back over my shoulder and saw that the Federal had been swallowed by the mist. The red cinder block wall faded to a thin wash pink and then disappeared utterly, probably 5 feet on the Bridgeton Pharmacy side of the outdoor. I felt more isolated, more simply alone than ever in my life. It was as if I had lost the womb. The pharmacy had been the scene of a slaughter. Miller and I, of course, were very close to it, almost on top of it. All the things in the mist operated primarily by sense of smell. It stood to reason. Sight would have been almost completely useless to them. Hearing a little better, but as I've said, the mist had a way of screwing up the acoustics, making things that were close sound distant, and sometimes things that were far away sound close. The things in the mist followed their truest sense. They followed their noses. Those of us in the market had been saved by the power outage as much as by anything else. The electric eye doors wouldn't operate. In a sense, the market had been sealed up when the mist came. But the pharmacy doors, they had been chocked open. The power failure had killed their air conditioning, and they had opened the doors to let in the breeze. Only something else had come in as well. A man in a maroon T-shirt lay face down in the doorway. Or at first I thought his T-shirt was maroon. Then I saw a few white patches at the bottom and understood that once it had been all white. The maroon was dried blood. And there was something else wrong with him. I puzzled it over in my mind. Even when Buddy Eagleton turned around and was noisily sick, it didn't come immediately. I guess when something that final happens to someone, your mind rejects it at first. Unless maybe you're in a war. His head was gone. That's what it was. His legs were splayed out inside the pharmacy doors, and his head should have been hanging over the low step, but his head just wasn't. Jim Grondon had had enough. He turned away, his hands over his mouth, his bloodshot eyes gazing madly into mine. Then he staggered back toward the market. The others took no notice. Miller had stepped inside. Mike Hatlin followed. Mrs. Rappler stationed herself at one side of the double doors with her tennis racket. Ollie stood on the other side with Amanda's gun drawn and pointing at the pavement. He said quietly,
I seem to be running out of hope, David.
Buddy Eagleton was leaning weakly against the payphone stall like someone who has just gotten bad news from home. His broad shoulders shook with the force of his sobs. Don't count us out yet, I said to Ollie. I stepped up to the door. I didn't want to go inside, but I had promised my son a comic book. The Bridgeton Pharmacy was a crazy shambles. Paperbacks and magazines were everywhere. There was a Spider-Man comic and an Incredible Hulk almost at my feet, and without thinking, I picked them up and jammed them into my back pocket for Billy. Bottles and boxes lay in the aisles. A hand hung over one of the racks. Unreality washed over me. The wreckage, the carnage, that was bad enough. But the place also looked like it had been the scene of some crazy party. It was hung and festooned with what I at first took to be streamers, but they weren't broad and flat. They were more like very thick strings of very thin cables. It struck me that they were almost the same bright white as the mist itself, and a cold chill sketched its way up my back like frost. Not crepe. What? Magazines and books hung dangling in the air from some of them. My Catlin was prodding a strange black thing with one foot. It was long and bristly. "What the fuck is this?" he asked no one in particular. And suddenly I knew. I knew what had killed all those unlucky enough to be in the pharmacy when the mist came. The people who had been unlucky enough to get smelled out. Out. Out, I said. My throat was completely dry, and the word came out like a lint-covered bullet. Get out of here! Ollie looked at me.
David?
They're spider webs, I said. And then two screams came out of the mist. The first of fear, maybe, the second of pain. It was Jim. If there were dues to be paid, he was paying them. Get out! I shouted at Mike and Dan Miller. Then something looped out of the mist. It was impossible to see it against that white background, but I could hear it. It sounded like a bullwhip that had been half-heartedly flicked. And I could see it when it twisted around the thigh of Buddy Eagleton's jeans. He screamed and grabbed for the first thing handy, which happened to be the telephone. The handset flew the length of its cord and then swung back and forth.
Oh, Jesus, that hurts!
Buddy screamed. Ollie grabbed for him, and I saw what was happening. At the same instant, I understood why the head of the man in the doorway was missing. The thin white cable that had twisted around Buddy's leg, like a silk rope, was sinking into his flesh. That leg of his jeans had been neatly cut off and was sliding down his leg. A neat circular incision in his flesh was brimming blood as the cable went deeper. Ollie pulled him hard. There was a thin, snapping sound, and Buddy was free. His lips had gone blue with shock. Mike and Dan were coming, but too slowly. Then Dan ran into several hanging threads and got stuck, exactly like a bug on flypaper. He freed himself with a tremendous jerk, leaving a flap of his shirt hanging from the webbing. Suddenly the air was full of those languorous bullwhip cracks, and the thin white cables were drifting down all around us. They were coated with the same corrosive substance. I dodged two of them, more by luck than by skill. One landed at my feet, and I could hear a faint hiss of bubbling hot top. Another floated out of the air, and Mrs. Repler calmly swung her tennis racket at it. The thread stuck fast, and I heard a high-pitched twing, twing, twing as the corrosive ate through the racket's strings and snapped them. It sounded like someone rapidly plucking the strings of a violin. A moment later, a thread wrapped around the upper handle of the racket, and it was jerked into the mist.
"Get back!"
Ollie screamed. We got moving. Ollie had an arm around Buddy. Dan Miller and Mike Hatlin were on each side of Mrs. Repler. The white strands of web continued to drift out of the fog, impossible to see unless your eye could pick them out against the red cinder block background. One of them wrapped around Mike Hatlin's left arm. Another whipped around his neck in a series of quick, winding-up snaps. His jugular went in a jetting, jumping explosion, and he was dragged away, head lolling. One of his bath loafers fell off and lay there on its side. Buddy suddenly slumped forward, almost dragging Ollie to his knees.
"He's passed out, David. Help me."
I grabbed Buddy around the waist, and we pulled him along in a clumsy, stumbling fashion. Even in unconsciousness, Buddy kept his grip on his steel pinch bar. The leg that the strand of web had wrapped around hung away from his body at a terrible angle. Mrs. Repler had turned around.
"Where?" she screamed in her rusty voice. "Where? Behind you!"
As I started to turn, one of the web strands floated down on top of Dan Miller's head. His hands beat at it, tore at it. One of the spiders had come out of the mist from behind us. It was the size of a big dog. It was black with yellow piping. Racing stripes, I thought crazily. Its eyes were reddish-purple, like pomegranates. It strutted busily toward us on what might have been as many as 12 or 14 many-jointed legs.
It was no ordinary earthly spider blown up to horror movie size. It was something totally different, perhaps not really a spider at all. Seeing it, Mike Hatlin would have understood what that bristly black thing he had been prodding at in the pharmacy really was. It closed in on us, spinning its webbing from an oval-shaped orifice on its upper belly. The strands floated out toward us in what was nearly a fan shape. Looking at this nightmare, so like the death black spiders brooding over their dead flies and bugs in the shadows of our boathouse, I felt my mind trying to tear completely loose from its moorings. I believe now that it was only the thought of Billy that allowed me to keep any semblance of sanity. I was making some sound, laughing, crying, screaming, I don't know. But Ollie Weeks was like a rock. He raised Amanda's pistol as calmly as a man on a target range and emptied it in spaced shots into the creature at point-blank range. Whatever hell it came from, it wasn't invulnerable. A black ichor splatted from its body, and it made a terrible mewling sound, so low it was more felt than heard, like a bass note from a synthesizer. Then it scuttled back into the mist and was gone. It might have been a phantasm from a horrible drug dream, except for the puddles of sticky black stuff it had left behind. There was a clang as Buddy finally dropped his steel pinch bar.
"He's dead,"
Ollie said.
"Let him go, David. The fucking thing got his femoral artery. He's dead. Let's get the Christ out of here."
His face was once more running with sweat, and his eyes bulged from his big round face. One of the web strands floated easily down on the back of his hand, and Dolly swung his arm, snapping it. The strand left a bloody wheel. Mrs. Rappler screamed, "Where?" again, and we turned toward her. Another of them had come out of the mist and had wrapped its legs around Dan Miller in a mad lover's embrace. He was striking at it with his fist. As I bent and picked up Buddy's pinch bar, the spider began to wrap Dan in its deadly thread, and his struggles became a grisly, jittering death dance. Mrs. Rattler walked toward the spider with a can of Black Flag insect repellent held outstretched in one hand. The spider's legs reached for her. She depressed the button, and a cloud of the stuff jetted into one of its sparkling, jewel-like eyes. The low-pitched mewling sound came again. The spider seemed to shudder all over, and then it began to lurch backward, hairy legs scratching at the pavement. It dragged Dan's body, bumping and rolling behind it. Mrs. Rattler threw the can of bug spray at it. It bounced off the spider's body and clattered to the hot tub. The spider struck the side of a small sports car hard enough to make it rock on its springs, and then it was gone. I got to Mrs. Rappler, who was swaying on her feet and dead pale. I put an arm around her.
"Thank you, young man," she said. "I feel a bit faint."
"That's okay," I said hoarsely.
"I would have saved him if I could."
"I know that." Ollie joined us. We ran for the market doors, the threads falling all around us. One lit on Mrs. Rattler's marketing basket and sank into the canvas side. She tussled grimly for what was hers, dragging back on the strap with both hands, but she lost it. It went bumping off into the mist, end over end. As we reached the end door, a smaller spider, no bigger than a cocker spaniel puppy, raced out of the fog along the side of the building. It was producing no webbing. Perhaps it wasn't mature enough to do so. As Ollie leaned one beefy shoulder against the door so Mrs. Rappler could go through, I heaved the steel bar at the thing like a javelin and impaled it. It writhed madly, legs scratching at the air, and its red eyes seemed to find mine and mark me.
"David?"
Ollie was still holding the door. I ran in. He followed me. Pallid, frightened faces stared at us. Seven of us had gone out. Three of us had come back. Ollie leaned against the heavy glass door, barrel chest heaving. He began to reload Amanda's gun. His white assistant manager's shirt was plastered to his body, and large gray sweat stains had crept out from under his arms.
"What?"
someone asked in a low, hoarse voice.
"Spiders,"
Mrs. Rappler answered grimly.
"The dirty bastard snatched my market basket."
Then Billy hurled his way into my arms, crying. I held on to him, tight. 10. The Spell of Mrs. Carmody. The second night in the market. The final confrontation. It was my turn to sleep, and for 4 hours I remember nothing at all. Amanda told me I talked a lot, and screamed once or twice, but I remember no dreams. When I woke up, it was afternoon. I was terribly thirsty. Some of the milk had gone over, but some of it was still okay. I drank a quart. Amanda came over to where Billy, Mrs. Terman, and I were. The old man who had offered to make a try for the shotgun in the trunk of his car was with her. Cornell, I remembered. Ambrose Cornell.
How are you, son?
He asked. All right. But I was still thirsty, and my head ached. Most of all, I was scared. I slipped an arm around Billy and looked from Cornell to Amanda. What's up? Amanda said.
Mr. Cornell is worried about that Mrs. Carmody.
So am I.
Billy, why don't you take a walk over here with me?
Hattie asked. I don't want to, Billy said. Go on, Big Bill, I told him. And he went, reluctantly. Now, what about Mrs. Carmody? I asked.
She's stirring things up,
Cornell said. He looked at me with an old man's grimness.
I think we got to put a stop to it, just about any way we can.
Amanda said,
there are almost a dozen people with her now. It's like some crazy kind of a church service.
I remembered talking with a writer friend who lived in Otisfield and supported his wife and 2 kids by raising chickens and turning out 1 paperback original a year, Spy Stories. We had gotten talking about the bulge in popularity of books concerning themselves with the supernatural. Galt pointed out that in the 40s, weird tales had only been able to pay a pittance, and that in the 50s it went broke. When the machines fail, he had said, while his wife candled eggs and roosters crowed querulously outside, when the technologies fail, when the conventional religious systems fail, people have got to have something. Even a zombie lurching through the night can seem pretty cheerful, compared to the existential comedy horror of the ozone layer dissolving under the combined assault of 1 million fluorocarbon spray cans of deodorant. We had been trapped here for 26 hours, and we hadn't been able to do diddly shit. Our 1 expedition outside had resulted in 57% losses. It wasn't so surprising that Mrs. Carmody had turned into a growth stock, maybe. Has she really got 12 people? I asked.
Well, only 8.
Cornell said.
But she never shuts up. It's like those 10-hour speeches Castro used to make. It's a goddamn filibuster.
8 people. Not that many. Not even enough to fill up a jury box. But I understood the worry on their faces. It was enough to make them the single largest political force in the market, especially now that Dan and Mike were gone. The thought that the biggest single group in our closed system was listening to her rant on about the pits of hell and the 7 vials being opened made me feel pretty damn claustrophobic.
She started talking about human sacrifice again, Amanda said. Bud Brown came over and told her to stop talking that drivel in his store. And 2 of the men that are with her, one of them was that man Myron LaFleur, told him he was the one who better shut up because it was still a free country. He wouldn't shut up, and there was a shoving match, I guess you'd say.
Brown got a bloody nose, Cornell said. They mean business.
I said, surely not to the point of actually killing someone. Cornell said softly,
I don't know how far they'll go if that mist doesn't let up, but I don't want to find out. I intend to get out of here.
Easier said than done. But something had begun to tick over in my mind. Scent. That was the key. We had been left pretty much alone in the market. The bugs might have been attracted to the light, as more ordinary bugs were. The birds had simply followed their food supply. But the bigger things had left us alone, unless we unbuttoned for some reason. The slaughter in the Bridgeton pharmacy had occurred because the doors had been left chopped open. I was sure of that. The thing or things that had gotten Norton and his party had sounded as big as a house, but it or they hadn't come near the market. And that meant that maybe... Suddenly, I wanted to talk to Ollie Weeks. I needed to talk to him.
I intend to get out or die trying, Cornell said.
I got no plans to spend the rest of the summer in here.
There have been 4 suicides,
Amanda said suddenly.
What?
The first thing to cross my mind, in a semi-guilty flash, was that the bodies of the soldiers had been discovered.
Pills, Cornell said shortly. Me and 2 or 3 other guys carried the bodies out back.
I had to stifle a shrill laugh. We had a regular morgue going back there.
It's thinning out,
Cornell said. I want to get gone. You won't even make it to your car, believe me.
Not even to that first rank? That's closer than the drugstore.
I didn't answer him. Not then. About an hour later, I found Ollie holding up the beer cooler and drinking a bush. His face was impassive, but he also seemed to be watching Mrs. Carmody. She was tireless, apparently, and she was indeed discussing human sacrifice again. Only now, no one was telling her to shut up. Some of the people who had told her to shut up yesterday were either with her today or at least willing to listen, and the others were outnumbered.
He could have them talked around to it by tomorrow morning,
Ollie remarked.
Maybe not. But if she did, who do you think she'd single out for the honor?
Bud Brown had crossed her. So had Amanda. There was the man who had struck her. And then, of course, there was me. Ollie, I said, I think maybe 6 of us could get out of here. I don't know how far we'd get, but I think we could at least get out.
How?
I laid it out for him. It was simple enough. If we dashed across to my scout and piled in, they would get no human scent, at least not with the windows rolled up.
But suppose they're attracted to some other scent,
Ollie asked.
Exhaust, for instance.
Then we'd be cooked, I agreed.
Motion, he said. The motion of a car through fog might also draw them, David.
I don't think so. Not without the scent of prey. I really believe that's the key to getting away.
But you don't know.
No, not for sure.
Where would you want to go?
First, home to get my wife.
David.
All right, to check. To be sure.
The things out there could be every place, David. They could get you the minute you stepped out of your scout into your dooryard.
If that happened, the scout would be yours. All I'd ask would be that you take care of Billy as well as you could for as long as you could. Ollie finished his bush and dropped the can back into the cooler, where it clattered among the empties. The butt of the gun Amanda's husband had given her protruded from his pocket.
South?
He asked, meeting my eyes. Yeah, I would, I said. Go south and try to get out of the mist. Try like hell.
How much gas you got?
Almost full.
Have you thought that it might be impossible to get out?
I had. Suppose what they had been fooling with at the Arrowhead Project had pulled this entire region into another dimension as easily as you or I would turn a sock inside out. It had crossed my mind, I said, but the alternative seems to be waiting around to see who Mrs. Carmody taps for the place of honor.
Were you thinking about today?
No, it's afternoon already, and those things get active at night. I was thinking about tomorrow, very early.
Who would you want to take?
Me and you and Billy. Hattie Terman, Amanda Dumfries, that old guy Cornell, and Mrs. Reppler. Maybe Bud Brown, too. That's 8. But Billy can sit on someone's lap, and we can all squash together. He thought it over.
All right, he said finally. We'll try. Have you mentioned this to anyone else?
No, not yet.
My advice would be not to. Not until about 4 tomorrow morning. I'll put a couple of bags of groceries under the checkout nearest the door. If we're lucky, we can squeak out before anyone knows what's happening.
His eyes drifted to Mrs. Carmody again.
If she knew, she might try to stop us.
You think so? Ollie got another beer.
I think so, he said.
That afternoon, yesterday afternoon, passed in a kind of slow motion. Darkness crept in, turning the fog to that dull chrome color again. What world was left outside slowly dissolved to black by 8:30. The pink bugs returned, then the bird things, swooping into the windows and scooping them up.
Something roared occasionally from the dark, and once, shortly before midnight, there was a long, drawn-out "Aroo" that caused people to turn toward the blackness with frightened, searching faces. It was the sort of sound you'd imagine a bull alligator might make in a swamp. It went pretty much as Miller had predicted. By the small hours, Mrs. Carmody had gained another half a dozen souls. Mr. McVeigh, the butcher, was among them, standing with his arms folded, watching her. She was totally wound up. She seemed to need no sleep. Her sermon, a steady stream of horrors out of Doré, Bosch, and Jonathan Edwards, went on, building toward some climax. Her group began to murmur with her, to rock back and forth unconsciously, like true believers at a tent revival. Their eyes were shiny and black. They were under her spell. Around 3 a.m., the sermon went on relentlessly, and the people who were not interested had retreated to the back to try to get some sleep. I saw Ollie put a bag of groceries on a shelf under the checkout nearest the outdoor. Half an hour later, he put another bag beside it. No one appeared to notice him but me. Billy, Amanda, and Mrs. Terman slept together by the denuded cold-cut section. I joined them and fell into an uneasy doze. At 4:15 by my wristwatch, Ollie shook me awake. Cornell was with him, his eyes gleaming brightly from behind his spectacles.
"It's time, David,"
Ollie said. A nervous cramp hit my belly and then passed. I shook Amanda awake. The question of what might happen with both Amanda and Stephanie in the car together passed into my mind and then passed right out again. Today it would be best to take things just as they came. Those remarkable green eyes opened and looked into mine.
"David?
We're going to take a stab at getting out of here. Do you want to come?"
"What are you talking about?"
I started to explain, then woke up Mrs. Terman so I would only have to go through it once.
"Your theory about sense," Amanda said. "It's really only an educated guess at this point, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"It doesn't matter to me,"
Hattie said. Her face was white, and in spite of the sleep she'd gotten, there were large, discolored patches under her eyes.
"I would do anything, take any chances, just to see the sun again."
Just to see the sun again. A little shiver coursed through me. She had put her finger on a spot that was very close to the center of my own fears, on the sense of almost foregone doom that had gripped me since I had seen Norm dragged out through the loading door. You could only see the sun through the mist, as a little silver coin. It was like being on Venus. It wasn't so much the monstrous creatures that lurked in the mist. My shot with the pinch bar had shown me they were no Lovecraftian horrors with immortal life, but only organic creatures with their own vulnerabilities. It was the mist itself that sapped the strength and robbed the will. Just to see the sun again. She was right. That alone would be worth going through a lot of hell. I smiled at Hattie, and she smiled tentatively back.
"Yes," Amanda said. "Me too."
I began to shake Billy awake as gently as I could.
"I'm with you,"
Mrs. Rattler said briefly. We were all together by the meat counter, all but Bud Brown. He had thanked us for the invitation and then declined it. He would not leave his place in the market, he said, but added in a remarkably gentle tone of voice that he didn't blame Ollie for doing so. An unpleasant, sweetish aroma was beginning to drift up from the white enamel case now, a smell that reminded me of the time our freezer went on the fritz while we were spending a week on the Cape. Perhaps I thought, it was the smell of spoiling meat that had driven Mr. McVeigh over to Mrs. Carmody's team.
"Expiation! It's expiation we want to think about now. We have been scourged with whips and scorpions. We have been punished for delving into secrets forbidden by God of old. We have seen the lips of the earth open. We have seen the obscenities of nightmare. The rock will not hide them. The dead tree gives no shelter. And how will it end? What will stop it?"
"Expiation," shouted good old Myron LaFleur.
Expiation.
Expiation. They whispered it uncertainly.
Let me hear you say it like you mean it,
Mrs. Carmody shouted. The veins stood out on her neck in bulging cords. Her voice was cracking and hoarse now, but still full of power. And it occurred to me that it was the mist that had given her that power. The power to cloud men's minds, to make a particularly apt pun, just as it had taken away the sun's power from the rest of us. Before, she had been nothing but a mildly eccentric old woman with an antique store in a town that was lousy with antique stores. Nothing but an old woman with a few stuffed animals in the back room and a reputation for... that witch, that cunt, folk medicine. It was said she could find water with an applewood stick, that she could charm warts, and sell you a cream that would fade freckles to shadows of their former selves. I had even heard, was it from old Bill Justy, that Mrs. Carmody could be seen, in total confidence, about your love life, that if you were having the bedroom miseries, she could give you a drink that would put the ram back in your rod. Expiation! They all cried together.
Expiation? That's right!
She shouted deliriously.
It's expiation gonna clear away this fog. Expiation gonna clear off these monsters and abominations. Expiation gonna drop the scales of mist from our eyes and let us see.
Her voice dropped a notch.
And what does the Bible say expiation is? What is the only cleanser for sin in the eye and mind of God?
Blood! This time the chill shuddered up through my entire body, cresting at the nape of my neck and making the hairs there stiffen. Mr. McVeigh had spoken that word. Mr. McVeigh, the butcher, who had been cutting meat in Bridgeton ever since I was a kid, holding my father's talented hand. Mr. McVeigh taking orders and cutting meat in his stained whites. Mr. McVeigh, whose acquaintanceship with the knife was long. Yes. And with the saw and cleaver as well. Mr. McVeigh, who would understand better than anyone else that the cleanser of the soul flows from the wounds of the body.
Blood,
they whispered.
Daddy, I'm scared,
Billy said. He was clutching my hand tightly, his small face strained and pale. Ollie, I said, why don't we get out of this loony bin?
Right on, he said. Let's go.
We started down the second aisle in a loose group. Ollie, Amanda, Cornell, Mrs. Terman, Mrs. Reppler, Billy, and I. It was 4:45 in the morning, and the mist was beginning to lighten again.
You and Cornell take the grocery bags,
Ollie said to me. Okay.
I'll go first. Your scout is a four-door, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I'll open the driver's door and the back door on the same side. Mrs. Dumfries, can you carry Billy?
She picked him up in her arms.
Am I too heavy?
Billy asked.
No, hon.
Good.
You and Billy get in front,
Ollie went on.
Shove way over. Mrs. Terman in front, in the middle. David, you behind the wheel. The rest of us will... Where did you think you were going?
It was Mrs. Carmody. She stood at the head of the checkout line where Ollie had hidden the bags of groceries. Her pantsuit was a yellow scream in the gloom. Her hair... frizzed out wildly in all directions, reminding me momentarily of Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. Her eyes blazed. 10 or 15 people stood behind her, blocking the in and outdoors. They had the look of people who had been in car accidents, or who had seen a UFO land, or who had seen a tree pull its roots up and walk. Billy cringed against Amanda and buried his face against her neck.
"Going out now, Mrs. Carmody,"
Ollie said. His voice was curiously gentle.
"Stand away, please." "You can't go out. That way is death. Don't you know that by now?"
"No one has interfered with you," I said. "All we want is the same privilege." She bent and found the bags of groceries unerringly. She must have known what we were planning all along. She pulled them out from the shelf where Ollie had placed them. One ripped open, spilling cans across the floor. She threw the other, and it smashed open with the sound of breaking glass. Soda ran fizzing every which way and sprayed off the chrome facing of the next checkout lane.
"These are the sort of people who brought it on," she shouted. "People who will not bend to the will of the Almighty. Sinners in pride, haughty they are, and
stiff-necked. It is from their number that the sacrifice must come. From their number, the blood of expiation.
A rising rumble of agreement spurred her on. She was in a frenzy now. Spittle flew from her lips as she screamed at the people crowding up behind her.
It's the boy we want! Grab him! Take him! It's the boy we want!
They surged forward, Myron LaFleur in the lead, his eyes blankly joyous. Mr. McVeigh was directly behind him, his face blank and stolid. Amanda faltered backward, holding Billy more tightly. His arms were wrapped around her neck. She looked at me, terrified.
David, what do I... Get them both!
Mrs. Carmody screamed.
Get his whore, too!
She was an apocalypse of yellow and dark joy. Her purse was still over her arm. She began to jump up and down.
Get the boy! Get the whore! Get them both! Get them all! Get...
A single sharp report rang out. Everything froze, as if we were a classroom full of unruly children, and the teacher had just stepped back in and shut the door sharply. Myron LaFleur and Mr. McVeigh stopped where they were, about 10 paces away. Myron looked back uncertainly at the butcher. He didn't look back or even seem to realize that LaFleur was there. Mr. McVeigh had a look I had seen on too many other faces in the last 2 days. He had gone over. His mind had snapped. Myron backed up, staring at Ollie Weeks with widening, fearful eyes. His backing up became a run. He turned the corner of the aisle, skidded on a can, fell down, scrambled up again, and was gone. Ollie stood in the classic target shooter's position, Amanda's gun clasped in both hands. Mrs. Carmody still stood at the head of the checkout lane. Both of her liver-spotted hands were clasped over her stomach. Blood poured out between her fingers and splashed her yellow slacks. Her mouth opened and closed once, twice. She was trying to talk. At last, she made it.
You will all die out there,
she said, and then she pitched slowly forward. Her purse slithered off her arm, struck the floor, and spilled its contents. A paper-wrapped tube rolled across the distance between us and struck one of my shoes. Without thinking, I bent over and picked it up. It was a half-used package of Rolaids. I threw it down again. I didn't want to touch anything that belonged to her. The congregation was backing away, spreading out, their focus broken. None of them took their eyes from the fallen figure and the dark blood spreading out from beneath her body.
You murdered her!
Someone cried out in fear and anger, but no one pointed out that she had been planning something similar for my son. Ollie was still frozen in his shooter's position, but now his mouth was trembling. I touched him gently. Ollie, let's go. And thank you.
I killed her,
he said hoarsely.
Damn if I didn't kill her.
Yes, I said. That's why I thanked you. Now let's go. We began to move again. With no grocery bags to carry, thanks to Mrs. Carmody, I was able to take Billy. We paused for a moment at the door, and Ollie said in a low, strained voice,
I wouldn't have shot her, David. Not if there had been any other way.
Yeah.
You believe it?
Yeah, I do.
Then let's go.
We went out. 11. The end. Ollie moved fast, the pistol in his right hand. Before Billy and I were more than out the door, he was at my scout, an insubstantial Ollie, like a ghost in a television movie. He opened the driver's door, then the back door. Then something came out of the mist and cut him nearly in half. I never got a good look at it, and for that I think I'm grateful. It appeared to be red, the angry color of a cooked lobster. It had claws. It was making a low grunting sound, not much different from the sound we had heard after Norton and his little band of flat earthers went out. Ollie got off one shot, and then the thing's claws scissored forward, and Ollie's body seemed to unhinge in a terrible glut of blood. Amanda's gun fell out of his hand, struck the pavement, and discharged. I caught a nightmare glimpse of huge, black, lusterless eyes, the size of giant handfuls of sea grapes. And then the thing lurched back into the mist with what remained of Ollie Weeks in its grip. A long, multi-segmented scorpion's body dragged harshly on the paving. There was an instant of choices. Maybe there always is, no matter how short. Half of me wanted to run back into the market with Billy hugged to my chest. The other half was racing for the scout, throwing Billy inside, lunging after him. Then Amanda screamed. It was a high, rising sound that seemed to spiral up and up until it was nearly ultrasonic. Billy cringed against me, digging his face against my chest. One of the spiders had Hattie Terman. It was big. It had knocked her down. Her dress had pulled up over her scrawny knees as it crouched over her, its bristly, spiny legs caressing her shoulders. It began to spin its web. Mrs. Carmody was right, I thought. We're going to die out here. We are really going to die out here. Amanda! I yelled. No response. She was totally gone. The spider straddled what remained of Billy's babysitter, who had enjoyed jigsaw puzzles and those damned double cross-sticks that no normal person can do without going nuts. Its threads crisscrossed her body, the white strands already turning red as the acid coating sank into her. Cornell was backing slowly toward the market, his eyes as big as dinner plates behind his specs. Abruptly, he turned and ran. He clawed the inn door open and ran inside. The split in my mind closed as Mrs. Rattler stepped briskly forward and slapped Amanda, first forehand, then backhand. Amanda stopped screaming. I went to her, spun her around to face the scout, and screamed, "Go!" into her face. She went. Mrs. Rattler brushed past me. She pushed Amanda into the scout's back seat, got in after her, and slammed the door shut. I yanked Billy loose and threw him in. As I climbed in myself, one of those spider threads drifted down and lit on my ankle. It burned, the way a fishing line pulled rapidly through your closed fist will burn. And it was strong. I gave my foot a hard yank, and it broke. I slipped in behind the wheel.
Shut it! Oh, shut the door, dear God!
Amanda screamed. I shut the door. A bare instant later, one of the spiders thumped softly against it. I was only inches from its red, viciously stupid eyes. Its legs, each as thick as my wrist, slipped back and forth across the square bonnet. Amanda screamed ceaselessly, like a fire bell.
"Woman, shut your head," Mrs. Rattler told him.
The spider gave up. It could not smell us, ergo we were no longer there. It strutted back into the mist on its unsettling number of legs, became a phantasm, and then was gone. I looked out the window to make sure it was gone, and then opened the door.
"What are you doing?"
Amanda screamed. But I knew what I was doing. I like to think Ollie would have done exactly the same thing. I half-stepped, half-leaned out, and got the gun. Something came rapidly toward me, but I never saw it. I pulled back in and slammed the door shut. Amanda began to sob. Mrs. Rattler put an arm around her and comforted her briskly. Billy said,
"Are we going home, Daddy?"
"Big Bill, we're gonna try."
"Okay,"
he said quietly. I checked the gun and then put it into the glove compartment. Ollie had reloaded it after the expedition to the drugstore. The rest of the shells had disappeared with him, but that was all right. He had fired at Mrs. Carmody. He had fired once at the clawed thing, and the gun had discharged once when it hit the ground. There were four of us in the scout, but if push came right down to shove, I'd find some other way out for myself. I had a terrible moment when I couldn't find my key ring. I checked all my pockets, came up empty, and then checked them all again, forcing myself to go slowly and calmly. They were in my jeans pocket. They had gotten down under the coins, as keys sometimes will. The scout started easily. At the confident roar of the engine, Amanda burst into fresh tears. I sat there, letting it idle, waiting to see what was going to be drawn by the sound of the engine or the smell of the exhaust. 5 minutes, the longest 5 of my life, drifted by. Nothing happened.
"Are we going to sit here, or are we going to go?"
Mrs. Rattler asked at last. "Go," I said. I backed out of the slot and put on the low beams. Some urge, probably a base one, made me cruise past the Federal Market as close as I could get. The scout's right bumper bunted the trash barrel to one side. It was impossible to see in except through the loopholes. All those fertilizer and lawn food bags made the place look as if it were in the throes of some mad garden sale. But at each loophole there were 2 or 3 pale faces staring out at us. Then I swung to the left, and the mist closed impenetrably behind us. And what has become of those people, I do not know. I drove back down Kansas Road at 5 miles an hour, feeling my way. Even with the scout's headlights and running lights on, it was impossible to see more than 7 or 10 feet ahead. The earth had been through some terrible contortion. Miller had been right about that. In places, the road was merely cracked, but in others, the ground itself seemed to have caved in, tilting up great slabs of paving. I was able to get over with the help of the four-wheel drive. Thank God for that. But I was terribly afraid that we would soon come to an obstacle that even the four-wheel drive couldn't get us over. It took me 40 minutes to make a drive that usually only took 7 or 8. At last, the sign that marked our private road loomed out of the mist. Billy, roused at 4:15, had fallen solidly asleep inside this car that he knew so well it must have seemed like home to him. Amanda looked at the road nervously.
Are you really going down there?
I'm going to try, I said. But it was impossible. The storm that had whipped through had loosened a lot of trees, and that weird, twisting drop had finished the job of tumbling them. I was able to crunch over the first two. They were fairly small. Then I came to a hoary old pine lying across the road like an outlaw's barricade. It was still almost 1/4 mile to the house. Billy slept on beside me, and I put the scout in park, put my hands over my eyes, and tried to think what to do next. Now, as I sit in the Howard Johnson's near exit 3 of the main turnpike, writing all of this down on Hojo's stationery, I suspect that Mrs. Repler, that tough and capable old broad, could have laid out the essential futility of the situation in a few quick strokes. But she had the kindness to let me think it through for myself. I couldn't get out. I couldn't leave them. I couldn't even kid myself that all the horror movie monsters were back at the Federal. When I cracked the window, I could hear them in the woods, crashing and blundering around on the steep fall of land they call the ledges around these parts. The moisture drip, drip, dripped from the overhanging leaves. Overhead, the mist darkened momentarily as some nightmarish and half-seen living kite overflew us. I tried to tell myself, then and now, that if she was very quick, if she buttoned up the house with herself inside, that she had enough food for 10 days to 2 weeks. It only works a little bit. What keeps getting in the way is my last memory of her, wearing her floppy sun hat and gardening gloves on her way to our little vegetable patch with the mist rolling inexorably across the lake behind her. It is Billy I have to think about now. Billy, I tell myself. Big Bill. Big Bill. I should write it maybe 100 times on this sheet of paper, like a child condemned to write, "I will not throw spitballs in school," as the sunny 3 o'clock stillness spills through the windows, and the teacher corrects homework papers at her desk, and the only sound is her pen, while somewhere, far away, kids pick up teams for scratch baseball. Anyway, at last I did the only thing I could do. I reversed the scout carefully back to Kansas Road. Then I cried. Amanda touched my shoulder timidly.
"David, I'm so sorry," she said.
"Yeah," I said, trying to stop the tears and not having much luck.
"Yeah, so am I."
I drove to Route 302 and turned left toward Portland. This road was also cracked and blasted in places, but was, on the whole, more passable than Kansas Road had been. I was worried about the bridges. The face of Maine is cut with running water, and there are bridges everywhere, big and small. But the Naples Causeway was intact, and from there it was plain, if slow, sailing all the way to Portland. The mist held thick. Once I had to stop, thinking that trees were lying across the road. Then the trees began to move and undulate, and I understood they were more tentacles. I stopped. And after a while, they drew back. Once, a great green thing with an iridescent green body and long transparent wings landed on the hood.
It looked like a grossly misshapen dragonfly. It hovered there for a moment, then took wing again and was gone. Billy woke up about 2 hours after we had left Kansas Road behind and asked if we had gotten Mommy yet. I told him I hadn't been able to get down our road because of fallen trees.
Is she all right, Dad?
Billy, I don't know, but we'll come back and see. He didn't cry. He dozed off again instead. I would have rather had his tears. He was sleeping too damn much, and I didn't like it. I began to get a tension headache. It was driving through the fog at a steady 5 or 10 miles an hour that did it, the tension of knowing that anything might come out of it, anything at all, a washout, a land spill, or Gidra the three-headed monster. I think I prayed. I prayed to God that Stephanie was alive and that he wouldn't take my adultery out on her. I prayed to God to let me get Billy to safety because he had been through so much. Most people had pulled to the side of the road when the mist came, and by noon, we were in North Windham. I tried the river road, but about 4 miles down, a bridge spanning a small and noisy stream had fallen into the water. I had to reverse for nearly a mile before I found a spot wide enough to turn around. We went to Portland by Route 302 after all. When we got there, I drove the cutoff to the turnpike. The neat line of toll booths guarding the access had been turned into vacant-eyed skeletons of smashed polar glass. All of them were empty. In the sliding glass doorway of one was a torn jacket with Maine Turnpike Authority patches on the sleeves. It was drenched with tacky, drying blood. We had not seen a single living person since leaving the settlement. Mrs. Rappler said,
"David, try your radio."
I slapped my forehead in frustration and anger at myself, wondering how I could have been stupid enough to forget the Scouts AM/FM for so long.
"Don't do that," Mrs. Rappler said curtly. "You can't think of everything. If you try, you will go mad and be of no use at all."
I got nothing but a shriek of static all the way across the AM band, and the FM yielded nothing but a smooth and ominous silence.
"Does that mean everything's off the air?"
Amanda asked. I knew what she was thinking, maybe. We were far enough south now so that we should have been picking up a selection of strong Boston stations, WRKO, WBZ, WNEX. But if Boston had gone... "It doesn't mean anything for sure," I said. "That static on the AM band is pure interference. The mist is having a damping effect on radio signals, too."
"Are you sure that's all it is?"
"Yes," I said. "Not sure at all." We went south. The mileposts rolled past, counting down from about 40. When we reached mile one, we would be at the New Hampshire border. Going on the turnpike was slower. A lot of the drivers hadn't wanted to give up, and there had been rear-end collisions in several places. Several times I had to use the median strip. At about 1:20, I was beginning to feel hungry, Billy clutched my arm.
"Danny, what's that? What's that?"
A shadow loomed out of the mist, staining it dark. It was as tall as a cliff and coming right at us. I jammed on the brakes. Amanda, who had been catnapping, was thrown forward. Something came. Again, that is all I can say for sure. It may have been the fact that the mist only allowed us to glimpse things briefly, but I think it just as likely that there are certain things that your brain simply disallows. There are things of such darkness and horror, just, I suppose, as there are things of such great beauty, that they will not fit through the puny human doors of perception. It was six-legged, I know that. Its skin was slaty gray that mottled to dark brown in places. Those brown patches reminded me absurdly of the liver spots on Mrs. Carmody's hands. Its skin was deeply wrinkled and grooved, and clinging to it were scores, hundreds of those pinkish bugs with the stalk eyes. I don't know how big it actually was, but it passed directly over us. One of its gray, wrinkled legs smashed down right beside my window, and Mrs. Rappler said later... she could not see the underside of its body, although she craned her neck up to look. She saw only two cyclopean legs going up and up into the mist like living towers until they were lost to sight. For the moment it was over the scout, I had an impression of something so big that it might have made a blue whale look the size of a trout. In other words, something so big that it defied the imagination. Then it was gone, sending a seismological series of thuds back. It left tracks in the cement of the interstate, tracks so deep I could not see the bottoms. Each single track was nearly big enough to drop the scout into. For a moment, no one spoke. There was no sound but our breathing and the diminishing thud of that great thing's passage. Then Billy said,
"Was it a dinosaur, Dan? Like the bird that got into the market?"
"I don't think so. I don't think there was ever an animal that big, Billy. At least not on Earth." I thought of the Arrowhead Project and wondered again what crazy damn thing they could have been doing up there.
"Can we go on?"
Amanda asked timidly.
"It might come back."
"Yes, and there might be more up ahead. But there was no point in saying so. We had to go somewhere." I drove on, weaving in and out between those terrible tracks until they veered off the road. That is what happened. Or nearly all. There is one final thing I'll get to in a moment. But you mustn't expect some neat conclusion. There is no, "And they escaped from the mist into the good sunshine of a new day," or "When we awoke, the National Guard had finally arrived," or even that great old standby, "It was all a dream." It is, I suppose, what my father always frowningly called an Alfred Hitchcock ending, by which he meant a conclusion in ambiguity that allowed the reader or viewer to make up his own mind about how things ended. My father had nothing but contempt for such stories, saying they were cheap shots. We got to this Howard Johnson's near Exit 3 as dusk began to close in, making driving a suicidal risk. Before that, we took a chance on the bridge that spans the Saco River. It looked badly twisted out of shape, but in the mist, it was impossible to tell if it was whole or not. That particular game we won. But there's tomorrow to think of, isn't there? As I write this, it is 1:15 in the morning, July the 23rd. The storm that seemed to signal the beginning of it all was only 4 days ago. Billy is sleeping in the lobby on a mattress that I dragged out for him. Amanda and Mrs. Rempler are close by. I am writing by the light of a big Delco flashlight, and outside, the pink bugs are ticking and thumping off the glass. Every now and then there is a louder thud as one of the birds takes one off. The scout has enough gas to take us maybe another 90 miles. The alternative is to try to gas up here. There is an Exxon out on the service island, and although the power is off, I believe I could siphon some up from the tank. But it means being outside. If we can get gas, here or further along, we'll keep going. I have a destination in mind now, you see. It's that last thing I wanted to tell you about. I couldn't be sure. That is the thing, the damn thing. It might have been my imagination, nothing but wish fulfillment. And even if not, it is such a long chance. How many miles? How many bridges? How many things that would love to tear up my son and eat him even as he screamed in terror and agony? The chances are so good that it was nothing but a daydream that I haven't told the others. At least not yet. In the manager's apartment, I found a large battery-operated multiband radio. From the back of it, a flat antenna wire led out through the window. I turned it on, switched over to BAT, fiddled with the tuning dial, with the squelch knob, and still got nothing but static or dead silence. And then, at the far end of the AM band, just as I was reaching for the knob to turn it off, I thought I heard, or dreamed I heard, one single word. There was no more. I listened for an hour, but there was no more. If there was that one word, it came through some minute shift in the damping mist, an infinitesimal break that immediately closed again. One word. I've got to get some sleep. If I can sleep and not be haunted until daybreak by the faces of Ollie Weeks and Mrs. Carmody and Norm the bag boy, and by Steph's face, half-shadowed by the wide brim of her sun hat. There is a restaurant here, a typical Hojo restaurant with a dining room and a long horseshoe-shaped lunch counter. I am going to leave these pages on the counter, and perhaps someday someone will find them and read them. One word. If I only really heard it. If only. I'm going to bed now, but first I'm going to kiss my son and whisper two words in his ear. Against the dreams that may come, you know. Two words that sound a bit alike. One of them is Hartford. The other is hope.
The Mist. 1. The Coming of the Storm. This is what happened. On the night that the worst heat wave in northern New England history finally broke, the night of July 19th, the entire western Maine region was lashed with the most vicious thunderstorms I have ever seen. We lived on Long Lake, and we saw the first of the storms beating its way across the water toward us just before dark. For an hour before, the air had been utterly still. The American flag that my father put up on our boathouse in 1936 lay limp against its pole. Not even its hem fluttered. The heat was like a solid thing, and it seemed as deep as sullen quarry water. That afternoon, the three of us had gone swimming, but the water was no relief unless you went out deep. Neither Steffi nor I wanted to go deep because Billy couldn't. Billy is 5. We ate a cold supper at 5:30, picking listlessly at ham sandwiches and potato salad out on the deck that faces the lake. Nobody seemed to want anything but Pepsi, which was in a steel bucket of ice cubes. After supper, Billy went out back to play on his monkey bars for a while. Steph and I sat without talking much, smoking and looking across the sullen, flat mirror of the lake to Harrison on the far side. A few powerboats droned back and forth. The evergreens over there looked dusty and beaten. In the west, great purple thunderheads were slowly building up, massing like an army. Lightning flashed inside them. Next door, Brent Norton's radio, tuned to that classical music station that broadcasts from the top of Mount Washington, sent out a loud bray of static each time the lightning flashed. Norton was a lawyer from New Jersey, and his place on Long Lake was only a summer cottage with no furnace or insulation. 2 years before, we had a boundary dispute that finally wound up in county court. I won. Norton claimed I won because he was an out-of-towner. There was no love lost between us. Steph sighed and fanned the top of her breasts with the edge of her halter. I doubted if it cooled her off much, but it improved the view a lot. "I don't want to scare you," I said, "but there's a bad storm on the way, I think." She looked at me doubtfully. "There were thunderheads last night and the night before, David. They just broke up."
"They won't do that tonight."
"No.
If it gets bad enough, we're going to go downstairs."
"How bad do you think it can get?"
"My dad was the first to build a year-round home on this side of the lake. When he was hardly more than a kid, he and his brothers put up a summer place where the house now stood. And in 1938, a summer storm knocked it flat, stone walls and all. Only the boathouse escaped. A year later, he started the big house. It's the trees that do the damage in a bad blow. They get old and the wind knocks them over. It's Mother Nature's way of cleaning house periodically." "I really don't know," I said, truthfully enough. I had only heard stories about the great storm of 38. "But the wind can come off the lake like an express train." Billy came back a while later, complaining that the monkey bars were no fun because he was all sweated up. I ruffled his hair and gave him another Pepsi. More work for the dentist. The thunderheads were getting closer, pushing away the blue. There was no doubt now that a storm was coming. Norton had turned off his radio. Billy sat between his mother and me, watching the sky, fascinated. Thunder boomed, rolling slowly across the lake and then echoing back again. The clouds twisted and rolled, now black, now purple, now veined, now black again. They gradually overspread the lake, and I could see a delicate caul of rain extending down from them. It was still a distance away. As we watched, it was probably raining on Bolster's Mills, or maybe even Norway. The air began to move, jerkily at first, lifting the flag and then dropping it again. It began to freshen and grew steady, first cooling the perspiration on our bodies and then seeming to freeze it. That was when I saw the silver veil rolling across the lake. It blotted out Harrison in seconds and then came straight at us. The powerboats had vacated the scene. Billy stood up from his chair, which was a miniature replica of our director's chairs, complete with his name printed on the back. "Daddy, look!" "Let's go in," I said. I stood up and put my arm around his shoulders.
"But do you see it? Dad, what is it?"
"A water cyclone. Let's go in." Staff threw a quick, startled glance at my face and then said, "Come on, Billy. Do what your father says." We went in through the sliding glass doors that give on the living room. I slid the door shut on its track and paused for another look out. The silver veil was 3/4 of the way across the lake. It had resolved itself into a crazily spinning teacup between the lowering black sky and the surface of the water, which had gone the color of lead streaked with white chrome. The lake had begun to look eerily like the ocean, with high waves rolling in and sending spume up from the docks and breakwaters. Out in the middle, big white caps were tossing their heads back and forth. Watching the water cyclone was hypnotic. It was nearly on top of us when lightning flashed so brightly that it printed everything on my eyes in negative for 30 seconds afterward. The telephone gave out a startled ting, and I turned to see my wife and son standing directly in front of the big picture window that gives us a panoramic view of the lake to the northwest. One of those terrible visions came to me. I think they are reserved exclusively for husbands and fathers. Of the picture window blowing in with a low, hard coughing sound and sending jagged arrows of glass into my wife's bare stomach, into my boy's face and neck. The horrors of the Inquisition are nothing compared to the fates your mind can imagine for your loved ones. I grabbed them both hard and jerked them away. "What the hell are you doing? Get away from there." Staff gave me a startled glance. Billy only looked at me as if he had been partially awakened from a deep dream. I led them into the kitchen and hit the light switch. The phone ting-a-linged again. Then the wind came. It was as if the house had taken off like a 747. It was a high, breathless whistling, sometimes deepening to a bass roar before glissading up to a whooping scream. "Go downstairs," I told Steph, and now I had to shout to make myself heard. Directly over the house, thunder whacked mammoth planks together, and Billy shrank against my leg.
"You come too,"
Staff yelled back. I nodded and made shooing gestures. I had to pry Billy off my leg. "Go with your mother. I want to get some candles in case the lights go off." He went with her, and I started opening cabinets. Candles are funny things, you know. You lay them by every spring, knowing that a summer storm may knock out the power. And when the time comes, they hide. I was pawing through the fourth cabinet, past the half ounce of grass that Steph and I bought 4 years ago and had still not smoked much of, past Billy's wind-up set of chattering teeth from the Auburn novelty shop, past the drifts of photos Steffi kept forgetting to glue in our album. I looked under a Sears catalog and behind a Cupid doll from Taiwan that I had won at the Freiburg Fair, knocking over wooden milk bottles with tennis balls. I found the candles behind the Cupid doll with its glazed dead man's eyes. They were still wrapped in their cellophane. As my hand closed around them, the lights went out and the only electricity was the stuff in the sky. The dining room was lit in a series of
shutter flashes that were white and purple. Downstairs, I heard Billy start to cry and the low murmur of staff soothing him. I had to have one more look at the storm. The water cyclone had either passed us or broken up when it reached the shoreline, but I still couldn't see 20 yards out onto the lake. The water was in complete turmoil. I saw someone's dock, the Jasser's maybe, hurry by with its main supports alternately turned up to the sky and buried in the churning water. I went downstairs. Billy ran to me and clung to my legs. I lifted him up and gave him a hug. Then I lit the candles. We sat in the guest room, down the hall from my little studio, and looked at each other's faces in the flickering yellow glow and listened to the storm roar and bash at our house. About 20 minutes later, we heard a ripping, rending crash as one of the big pines went down nearby. Then there was a lull. "Is it over?" Staff asked. "Maybe," I said. "Maybe only for a while." We went upstairs, each of us carrying a candle, like monks going to vespers. Billy carried his proudly and carefully. Carrying a candle, carrying the fire, was a very big deal for him. It helped him forget about being afraid. It was too dark to see what damage had been done around the house. It was past Billy's bedtime, but neither of us suggested putting him in. We sat in the living room, listened to the wind, and looked at the lightning. About an hour later, it began to crank up again. For 3 weeks, the temperature had been over 90, and on 6 of those 21 days, the National Weather Service station at the Portland Jetport had reported temperatures of over 100 degrees. Queer weather. Coupled with the grueling winter we had come through and the late spring, some people had dragged out that old chestnut about the long-range results of the 50s A-bomb test again. That and, of course, the end of the world, the oldest chestnut of them all. The second squall wasn't so hard, but we heard the crash of several trees weakened by the first onslaught. As the wind began to die down again, one thudded heavily on the roof, like a fist dropped on a coffin lid. Billy jumped and looked apprehensively upward. "It'll hold, champ," I said. Billy smiled nervously. Around 10 o'clock, the last squall came. It was bad. The wind howled almost as loudly as it had the first time, and lightning seemed to be flashing all around it. More trees fell, and there was a splintering crash down by the water that made Staff utter a low cry. Billy had gone to sleep on her lap. "David, what was that?" "I think it was the boathouse."
Oh, Jesus.
"Steffi, I want us to go downstairs again." I took Billy in my arms and stood up with him. Staff's eyes were big and frightened.
"David, are we going to be all right?"
"Yes."
"Really?"
"Yes." We went downstairs. 10 minutes later, as the final squall peaked, there was a splintering crash from upstairs, the picture window. So maybe my vision earlier hadn't been so crazy after all. Staff, who had been dozing, woke up with a little shriek, and Billy stirred uneasily in the guest bed.
"The rain will come in," she said. "It'll ruin the furniture."
"If it does, it does. It's insured."
"That doesn't make it any better," she said in an upset, scolding voice. "Your mother's dresser, our new sofa, the color TV."
"Shh," I said. "Go to sleep."
"I can't," she said.
And 5 minutes later, she had. I stayed awake for another half hour with one lit candle for company, listening to the thunder walk and talk outside. I had a feeling that there were going to be a lot of people from the lakefront communities calling their insurance agents in the morning. A lot of chainsaws burring as cottage owners cut up the trees that had fallen on their roofs and battered through their windows, and a lot of orange CMP trucks on the road. The storm was fading now, with no sign of a new squall coming in. I went back upstairs, leaving Staff and Billy on the bed, and looked into the living room. The sliding glass door had held, but where the picture window had been, there was now a jagged hole stuffed with birch leaves. It was the top of the old tree that had stood by our outside basement access for as long as I could remember.
Looking at its top, now visiting in our living room, I could understand what staff had meant by saying insurance didn't make it any better. I had loved that tree. It had been a hard campaigner of many winters, the one tree on the lakeside of the house that was exempt from my own chainsaw. Big chunks of glass on the rug reflected my candle flame over and over. I reminded myself to warn Staff and Billy. They would want to wear their slippers in here. Both of them liked to slop around barefoot in the morning. I went downstairs again. All three of us slept together in the guest bed, Billy between Steph and me. I had a dream that I saw God walking across Harrison on the far side of the lake, a God so gigantic that above the waist he was lost in a clear blue sky. In the dream, I could hear the rending crack and splinter of breaking trees as God stamped the woods into the shape of his footsteps. He was circling the lake, coming toward the Bridgeton side, toward us, and all the houses and cottages and summer places were bursting into purple-white flame like lightning, and soon the smoke covered everything. The smoke covered everything like a mist. After the storm, Norton, a trip to town.
Jeepers, Billy said.
He was standing by the fence that separates our property from Norton's and looking down our driveway. The driveway runs a quarter of a mile to a camp road which, in its turn, runs about three-quarters of a mile to a stretch of two-lane blacktop called Kansas Road. From Kansas Road, you can go anywhere you want, as long as it's Bridgeton. I saw what Billy was looking at, and my heart went cold. Don't go any closer, champ. Right there is close enough. Billy didn't argue. The morning was bright and as clear as a bell. The sky, which had been a mushy, hazy color during the heat wave, had regained a deep, crisp blue that was nearly autumnal. There was a light breeze, making cheerful sun dapples move back and forth in the driveway. Not far from where Billy was standing, there was a steady hissing noise, and in the grass there was what you might at first have taken for a writhing bundle of snakes. The power lines leading to our house had fallen in an untidy tangle about 20 feet away and lay in a burned patch of grass. They were twisting lazily and spitting. If the trees and grass hadn't been so completely damped down by the torrential rains, the house might have gone up. As it was, there was only that black patch where the wires had touched directly.
Could that electrocute a person, Daddy?
Yeah, it could.
What are we going to do about it?
Nothing. Wait for the CMP.
When will they come?
I don't know. 5-year-olds have as many questions as Hallmark has cards. I imagine they're pretty busy this morning. Want to take a walk up to the end of the driveway with me? He started to come and then stopped, eyeing the wires nervously. One of them humped up and turned over lazily as if beckoning.
Daddy, can electricity shoot through the ground?
A fair question. Yes, but don't worry. Electricity wants the ground, not you, Billy. You'll be all right if you stay away from the wires.
Wants the ground,
he muttered, and then came to me. We walked up the driveway holding hands. It was worse than I had imagined. Trees had fallen across the drive in 4 different places, one of them small, 2 of them middling, and one old baby that must have been 5 feet through the middle. Moss was crusted onto it like a moldy corset. Branches, some half-stripped of their leaves, lay everywhere in jackstraw profusion. Billy and I walked up to the camp road, tossing the smaller branches off into the woods on either side. It reminded me of a summer's day that had been maybe 25 years before. I couldn't have been much older than Billy was now. All my uncles had been here, and they had spent the day in the woods with axes and hatchets and Darcy poles, cutting brush. Later that afternoon, they had all sat down to the trestle picnic table my dad and Mom used to have, and there had been a monster meal of hot dogs and hamburgers and potato salad.
The Gansett beer had flowed like water, and my Uncle Reuben took a dive into the lake with all his clothes on, even his deck shoes. In those days, there were still deer in these woods. Daddy, can I go down to the lake? He was tired of throwing branches. And the thing to do with a little boy when he's tired is to let him go do something else. Sure. We walked back to the house together. And then Billy cut right, going around the house and giving the downed wires a large berth. I went left into the garage to get my McCullough. As I had suspected, I could already hear the unpleasant song of the chainsaw up and down the lake. I topped up the tank, took off my shirt, and was starting back up the driveway when Steph came out. She eyed the downed trees lying across the driveway nervously. How bad is it? I can cut it up. How bad is it in there? Well, I got the glass cleaned up, but you're going to have to do something about that tree, David. We can't have a tree in the living room. No, I said. I guess we can't. We looked at each other in the morning sunlight and got giggling. I set the McCullough down on the cement areaway and kissed her, holding her buttocks firmly. Don't, she murmured. Billy's. He came tearing around the corner of the house just then. Dad! Danny! You ought to see the... Steffi saw the live wires and screamed for him to watch out. Billy, who was a good distance away from them, pulled up short and stared at his mother as if she had gone mad. I'm okay, Mom, he said in the careful tone of voice he used to placate the very old and senile. He walked toward us, showing us how all right he was, and Steph began to tremble in my arms. It's all right, I said in her ear. He knows about them. Yes, but people get killed, she said. They have ads all the time on television about live wires. People get... Billy, I want you to come in the house right now. Aw, come on, Mom. I want to show Dad the boathouse. He was almost bug-eyed with excitement and disappointment. He had gotten a taste of post-storm apocalypse and wanted to share it. You go in right now. Those wires are dangerous and... Dad said they want the ground, not me. Billy, don't you argue with me. I'll come down and look, champ. Go on down yourself. I could feel Steph tensing against me. Go around the other side, kiddo. Yeah, okay. He tore past us, taking the stone steps that led around the west end of the house two by two. He disappeared with his shirt tail flying, trailing back one word. Wow! As he spotted some other piece of destruction. He knows about the wires, Steffi. I took it gently by the shoulders. He's scared of them. That's good. It makes him safe. One tear tracked down her cheek. David, I'm scared. Come on, it's over.
Is it? Last winter, and the late spring. They called it a black spring in town. They said there hadn't been one in these parts since 1888.
They undoubtedly meant Mrs. Carmody, who kept the Bridgeton Antiquary, a junk shop that Steph liked to rummage around in sometimes. Billy loved to go with her. In one of the shadowy, dusty back rooms, stuffed owls with gold-ringed eyes spread their wings forever as their feet endlessly grasped varnished logs. Stuffed raccoons stood in a trio around a stream that was a long fragment of dusty mirror. And one moth-eaten wolf, which was foaming sawdust instead of saliva around his muzzle, snarled a creepy, eternal snarl. Mrs. Carmody claimed the wolf was shot by her father as it came to drink from Stevens Brook one September afternoon in 1901. The expeditions to Mrs. Carmody's antiquary shop worked well for my wife and son. She was into carnival glass, and he was into death in the name of taxidermy. But I thought that the old woman exercised a rather unpleasant hold over Steph's mind, which was in all other ways practical and hard-headed. She had found Steph's vulnerable spot, a mental Achilles heel. Nor was Steph the only one in town who was fascinated by Mrs. Carmody's gothic pronouncements and folk remedies, which were always prescribed in God's name. Stump water would take off bruises if your husband was the sort who got a bit too free with his fists after three drinks. You could tell what kind of a winter was coming by counting the rings on the caterpillars in June, or by measuring the thickness of August honeycomb. And now, good God protect and preserve us, the Black Spring of 1888. Add your own exclamation points, as many as you think it deserves. I had also heard the story. It's one they like to pass around up here. If the spring is cold enough, the ice on the lakes will eventually turn as black as a rotted tooth. It's rare, but hardly a once-in-a-century occurrence. They like to pass it around, but I doubt that many could pass it around with as much conviction as Mrs. Carmody. We had a hard winter and a late spring, I said. Now we're having a hot summer, and we had a storm. But it's over. You're not acting like yourself, Stephanie. That wasn't an ordinary storm, she said in that same husky voice. No, I said. I'll go along with you there. I had heard the Black Spring story from Bill Josty, who owned and operated, after a fashion, Josty's Mobile in Casco Village. Bill ran the place with his three tosspot sons, with occasional help from his four tosspot grandsons, when they could take time off from tinkering with their snowmobiles and dirt bikes. Bill was 70, looked 80, and could still drink like 23 when the mood was on him. Billy and I had taken the scout in for a fill-up the day after a surprise mid-May storm dropped nearly a foot of wet, heavy snow on the region, covering the new grass and flowers. Josty had been in his cups